Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
I want to say a few things, and then we'll have a general catch-up discussion. Let me put that in my latest notes. Okay. First thing I want to talk about is about how to study philosophy. Yes.
Is this Eric Weiss?
Yes, it is.
May I come in?
Please.
Thank you.
Are you a visiting student or?
Yeah.
What's your name?
My name is Basag.
Basag?
Yes.
And everybody wants to meet Basag. Here he is. And then you can talk to him and tell him more about our program.
Hi.
Welcome, Basag. So I want to talk about studying philosophy and how it's done. And I want to tell you a very brief story. Last week, we had a great discussion in class, and I felt really good about it. And we had a lot of those great discussions last semester. And I was a little bit disappointed and surprised when the papers came, because I realized that although we're having these wonderful conversations in class, about a third of the people in class really weren't getting it and really weren't assimilating the ideas. And so can you close that door, Caleb, please? And so I began to realize that although we're having these great conversations in class, although there's a tremendous opportunity, just listening to the lectures isn't enough if you yourselves hope to become sources of philosophical illumination. Right? That's what I aspire to be, is a source of philosophical illumination, and I presume that those of you who are here in graduate school are also working to become in some way a source of inspiration and clarity for others. And it's clear to me that just coming to class and having a good time in class and participating in discussion isn't enough for that to happen. And so I want to talk to you about what it actually is like to study philosophy in such a way that you can become a source yourself. And the first thing to realize is that becoming a philosopher takes a lot of time. Thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of time. It just takes a huge amount of time. And the way you actually use that time is in very careful reading. Now, many of you haven't been taught how to read. And I think this is in part encouraged by the fact that you're assigned so many pages every week in most of your classes. And so you get the idea, I was a student recently enough to remember this, you get the idea that you're just supposed to get through the reading, because there's way too much reading to do anything more than get through it. And so how do you get through reading? Well, you just sit there and you read it, and you sort of let the words pour through, hoping you'll get to the end in time to go to bed or something, right? But the point is that when the words just pour through, you don't learn anything, right? Because that's not how learning happens. That's why I never assign usually any more than 50 pages. I consider reading 50 pages of philosophy to be a major task. And why is that? Because when you read philosophy, you have to pay attention to each and every sentence. Right? As you're reading, you have to pay attention to each sentence and make sure that you understand what it means. Now, that might mean you certainly have a dictionary next to you when you're studying philosophy, because it's often important to look up words, for example. Or another thing you might find is that you're reading along and you find a reference to some philosopher you don't know anything about. Still happens to me all the time, right? So you go to Wikipedia or something, right? And you get some sense of what that's about, so you're not totally lost, right? So the main thing is, though, as you go through, you study each sentence, and you make sure you're following the argument. And so the idea is that you want to understand each sentence in the context of the paragraph, and each paragraph in the context of the chapter, and each chapter in the context of the book. Right? So you're trying to build up a model of this thought space on these different levels, from global to local. Right? And this is not easy, right? So for example, when I pick up a new philosophy text, I'll start reading it, and I'll try really hard to understand every sentence. And I can't the first time through a book, because it's too unfamiliar, right? So when I get to the first place I don't understand, I'll think about it for a while, and even if I don't understand it, I'll go on anyway. right? And then I'll understand as much as I can. And then I'll find another place I don't understand, and I'll try. And after about three or four of those, I'm hopelessly lost. So at that point, I go back to the beginning of the book and start over. Now, usually, having read further than my first confusion, I've gotten some more ideas. And so on the second reading, my earlier confusion starts to clear up, right? And then I get a little further, and then I start getting bewildered, and then I go back to the beginning again, right? And so sometimes it might take three tries to get through a philosophy book, right? But you got to look at each thing. Every time you read something, you got to think, okay, do I understand what's being said? And there's a difference between just reading, which is kind of a passive activity like watching TV, or studying, which is an essentially active activity in which you're not just reading, but you're dialoguing with the material constantly, right? So the author puts out an idea and you might stop and think, you know, I don't really like what he's doing here. The definition doesn't seem right. You sort of note it. And then you go on, you see how that wrong definition affects the argument, right? So then in your next reading, you might see how the whole book doesn't make any sense because of the bad definition, stuff like that, right? But there's this constant building up of coherent understandings and a constant dialogue, a very active dialogue with what you're reading. Like, does this really make sense? Does it apply to my experience? Does it agree with what other philosophers that I've read have said? How is it different, right? So there's this extremely active process. Now, along with that, I very highly suggest the study of footnotes. Because if you want to become a scholar, footnotes are your way in. Right? So this is for two reasons. Every philosopher you read will be in a tradition. And there will be certain philosophers in the past who have particularly shaped her thinking. And so very often, if you find a new author you're excited about, the second thing you have to do is go back and read the people that person read, so you can start to understand what the guy you like did with it, right? This is kind of so. Some philosopher, somebody in the room could probably tell me who it is. Talks about the rhizome. Some French philosopher.
Deleuze.
Okay, I love that image, right? The rhizome is like all the networks of the mushrooms underground, right? This big complex sort of neural network-like thing, right? Well, that's what philosophy is like. It's like a rhizome, right? So every philosophy is embedded in historical context, right? And an intellectual context, and so to understand it, you have to get a sense of the context. So you move out into the context, then you move back down into the details, right? And there's this kind of movement, and it's a very active, dynamic movement. And remember what I said last time was that to think something through, to be philosophical is to think something through. And to think something through is to be able to line up all of its interesting features in a line, and to be able to think through those features in some systematic way. So your mind can traverse back and forth across that list with continuity and confidence. So when you're reading something, you have to look for the continuity. Like, what is it that strings the paragraphs and the chapters together? Right? What is the continuity here? What is the overall purpose of the text? And another really, I'm sort of pre-associating here, but another really important thing you need to look for is what is the question that is being answered? Sometimes this is the key. Actually, this is always a key to understanding any philosophical system, is understanding what are the questions that are being answered here. Because if you don't get a clear sense of the questions, you'll never understand the answer. Right? So as you're reading the text, you think, okay, what's he doing? What is the question? And often to understand the question, you have to understand the historical context. So Kant, for example, is stuck between Newton and Hume. If you don't understand that, you'll never get Kant. Right? You have to go back into the right, and you have to understand the various mechanistic forms of thought. So your understanding grows and deepens, right, as you explore the rhizome. But you have to pay careful attention to each link. So I want to give you a sense of the kind of active attention that's required, right? So I'm giving lectures in class, and they're fun, and I'm giving you some readings, but you need to be reading these things really actively. You see what I'm getting at? Right? And it takes a lot of time if you want to become a source. You have to put in a lot of time, right? And what I do is I take notes constantly, right? I've got, when I was doing my dissertation, I had this many typewritten pages of notes, right? I just write stuff down as I'm thinking. Like, what am I thinking? I get a new idea, I write it down. Or if I have a problem I'm working on, like I'll look back and I'll find maybe 60 or 80 different outlines, all trying to solve the same problem. And I'll start, and I'll go, then I'll sort of peter out and get lost in incoherence, and then I'll start again, right? Over and over again until I get all the way through it. So I want you to get some sense for just how much work it is to become a source of philosophical clarity. Any questions about that? Any observations about that?
I just really appreciate your taking the time to share that, because that's what I've been kind of struggling with, that I want to spend that kind of time engaging with the material and being given third permission.
Yeah, that's what it takes. So, yeah, Nick.
How do you kind of, you personally hold the kind of challenge of balancing breadth and depth? Because you're speaking to, you need to really engage this with depth.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah.
We're talking about these, you know, vast, you know, big picture philosophies of life and the integral, and there's so much context to really work with, you know, these ideas in a meaningful way. And, you know, some of us aren't, you know, the most amazing speed readers on the planet. We're not like Ken Wilber,
you can't
where
we
can go through a book in
Nobody
3 hours.
Nobody can read philosophy fast.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time, as far as I'm concerned, to read philosophy fast. If you read philosophy fast, you only see reflected in it what you already understand. Right, so what happens is you're reading along in your book, and if you read fast, you have sort of a general idea of what's going on. You sort of pick up a few highlights that sort of verify what you already think, right? But when you're reading along sentence by sentence, you come to one that doesn't quite make sense. Now, what does that mean? Well, maybe it's a badly written sentence. Maybe the author made a mistake. Or maybe you've been completely misinformed about everything you thought you understood, and this sentence is the key to revising your whole understanding. You don't know. Right, but you've got to pay attention to each sentence with the possibility that it might completely change your understanding of the whole text. And you can't do that if you aren't paying attention at a very deep level. So the answer to your question is that philosophers only gain depth by post-holing. Right? In other words, you have to pick something and go deep. Right? So for example, when I first started studying Whitehead, I gave it 3 years of my life. Right. I read Process and Reality at least 3 times. Right. I went to Cal Berkeley and I got out a whole bunch of secondary texts. Right. So for example, I was confused about some term in Whitehead. I'd go to the library and get 3 or 4 articles about that term. Right. The secondary literature is really helpful. Most of it's wrong. But when you read it, it stimulates you in terms of what are the issues. And when you see that they are wrong, you get an idea for how your own understanding needs to be shaped. Right? So the secondary literature, again, is extremely important. Any issue that you're going to come up with studying philosophy, 99% of them somebody else has already studied. And there's no point in reinventing the wheel. That's why the footnotes are so important, right? Whenever something is interesting, you look at the footnote, and if it's interesting enough, you get the book. So look at the book, right? So you begin exploring the networks, right? You go into the history of the philosopher, or you may go into the future. Who learned from that philosopher and improved them, right? It's like that, right? And so your knowledge is constantly expanding. But in order to learn anything in philosophy, you have to give it months. Right? So like, you know, you decide you want to go into Gebser, you've got to give it a year, really, I mean, at least. Right? To read The Ever-Present Origin 2 or 3 times, and to get whatever secondary literature you can, and to think about it, right? Then when you've done that with 4 or 5 or 6 philosophers, then you start to have breadth. And then you also stop and read surveys. I love survey books. In fact, when I have a new discipline I want to get into, like I want to study economics, that's the first thing I did was I went out and got a textbook on economics and read the whole thing, right? So then I got a sense of the overview of the field and a sort of a standard definition of the various approaches that had been taken. I picked one that was interesting to me. I went into it. And then I began to say it related to the ones before and the ones after it, right? So it's this constant movement from the global back to the local that has to be happening in your mind. And the objective has to be to think through everything. That's what a philosopher wants to do, is to be able to think through everything. But you start by being able to think through one thing and then another thing, okay? And you discover that each time you think one thing through, you use a certain set of ideas. But maybe you're thinking something else through, you use a different set of ideas. And you begin to wonder about the relationship between those two different sets of ideas, right? And so there's this constant movement, right, in which actually it seems like the objective is to create one overall logical system, but that never happens. What happens is that you create an island of clarity here, an island of clarity here, an island of clarity there, and then they begin to sort of link up with each other in sort of a general sort of way. And so you begin to get some sense that you're living in a coherent universe, but then every time you go into another area or an old area to re-clarify it, the whole system changes. Because you get some new insight that begins to ramify. So if I rethink concrescence, let's say, then the next time I think about the transphysical world, my thinking will be different because I rethought concrescence. Then I'll rethink the transphysical world, but that might lead me to go back and rethink concrescence again. Right? So there's this movement between these different islands of clarity, which gradually begins to establish a sense of philosophical coherence. But it's never possible to actually synthesize it all into one system. A great philosopher at a mature stage of his career will make that attempt and fail. It's part of the game, right? Because that attempt inspires other people to try again and maybe do better. So I wanted to talk to you about this and see if you can get some feeling for it. I now get that some of you are along for the ride and may not even be doing the reading, and some of you are really going to work hard, and I'm okay with that, right? But I want to give you the opportunity to know how it's done if you want to be up here teaching later, which is why you're in graduate school. One of the things I'm hoping you're thinking about. Okay. Any questions or comments about that? Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, just a comment, though. Kind of a crazy habit that works for me that makes this active learning that you're talking about is it's like I attack the text with a pencil and I underline everything in circle and box and exclamation points. I get all emotional about it. Ah, this is crap, I write.
That's a great way to do it. That's great.
It gets the engagement.
Yeah. So, okay. Second thing I want to talk about is...
question.
Yes. Linda.
All right. But so you say that you get some sense of coherence, but you can never get the whole picture. As we move into the integral age, do you think that's going to change, that philosophy, we see it differently where we can get the whole picture at once?
No. No, I think it's in the nature... Philosophy is a mental activity. It is. And it's native to the mental mutation. And although it has a very important place in the integral, it remains mental. And as such, it always deals with abstractions. And no set of abstractions can ever be adequate to the actual world. And so philosophy, it simply is not possible to come up with a rational system of the actual world, because the actual world is too complex for any rational system to do it full justice. Every rational system is responsive to certain values, is expressed at a certain time in history, is subject to certain unconscious presuppositions, because we can never articulate all of our unconscious presuppositions, right? And so every philosophical attempt is partial and historically situated. As I like to say it these days, every idea has a use-by date, right? And every idea is wrong if taken literally or pushed too far. This is the gift of the integral, and it's come to us through the deconstructionist, right? Is recognizing that every idea is wrong if taken literally or if pushed too far. But ideas can be immensely useful if handled with a sense of humor. Caleb, do you mind moving so I can see you? So you're not right behind that. Thanks. Okay. Anything else on that? Great. Next thing, about the readings for next week. The readings for next week, I've assigned the first 50 pages of Ledbetter's textbook of theosophy. I want you to know that I am completely aware of how dated this text is. And I'm not asking you to read it so you will become a theosophist or so that you will buy the system. I understand there are a lot of inadequacies with the system. But it's only 50 pages, and you get a lot. And the reason I'm presenting this to you is because this is the form in which these ideas reached the West in the late 1800s. And I believe that these ideas, number one, these texts, theosophical texts, woke me up to the whole transphysical world. And I found them uniquely compelling, but they're also uniquely compelling because of the way the moment of their creation is reflected in the text. This is what I want you to look for, okay? So what you'll see, now this is the 1890s, right, around there. This is the height of materialism. This is the darkest hour of the darkest age in the deficient mental, right? It's the total victory of mechanisms happening at this point. And Helena Blavatsky starts getting this transmission from Eastern teachers about the Vedic multi-world cosmology. And so she and her buddies decide to bring it to the West. And they do this by translating the Vedic cosmology into the materialistic terms of science. Right? So I want you to notice. Now, another reason this is important is because the ideas articulated in this book, and you'll see them about density and so forth, the idea of density and frequency and higher dimensions, all that kind of stuff, right? These are the same ideas that have been used by the New Age ever since then to express intuitions about the transphysical worlds. Right? Everybody talks about higher vibrations, right? Or higher dimensions, or you know, subtler planes, right? Less dense planes, right? All these ideas are completely expressed here by Ledbetter and have not changed since. Right? So you see the origin of these ideas in this book. Quite interesting, right? And some of the stuff, I mean, you sort of have to memorize it. I mean, it's crazy, you know? It's like there's one atom at this level and 49 at this level and 49 to the third power at this level. I mean, this is obviously kind of ridiculous. And the thing is also ridiculous because you'll notice that the mind-body problem is never tackled, right? So basically what they're saying is, we've now figured out the universe is made of atoms, but there are smaller and smaller atoms making up more and more subtle worlds. This is not adequate to the discussion of the transphysical worlds. And I think what I'm doing is trying to find a much more adequate way of doing what they were trying to do. But I want you to notice, as you read it, how materialist it is, right? How much the problem of consciousness really is hardly addressed, except by a deus ex machina called the second outpouring of God. So notice that, right? But also notice how some of the ideas are really compelling. Some of the ideas affected me. I've read this probably 30 or 40 years ago, and some of the ideas are still with me and affect me all the time. Right? So what's interesting is to notice how compelling it can be, how wrong it is, and the fact when it was written. Right? So, and also the fact that the ideas in this book have not been updated until my work. Right. So it's interesting. You know, I want you to see the background here. Now, about today's reading, and then we'll go into the lecture. About today's reading, Burt's book I consider to be a uniquely important book. I think for any PCC student, it should be on the PCC canon, as far as I'm concerned, because this book tackles a question that is absolutely urgent for all of us, because we grew up conditioned by scientific ideas. They haunt us and possess us. They infect our language. They're extremely difficult to get around. And Burt's book woke me up from the scientific trance by showing me the historical process through which scientific ideas came to dominate. And once I understood that, I was able to release any ontological hold that science had on my imagination. I strongly recommend the whole book. And I had you buy the book, even my only assigned 35 pages, because I'm really hoping you'll read it. I'm hoping the first 35 pages will turn you on. You don't have time to read it this semester, but I want you to own it, and I hope you read it, because it is, for anybody raised with an American education, this book is a necessary dental floss operation. Okay, any questions about that? Now, and also, now that I've done my preliminaries, any questions or comments regarding last week or ongoing issues that are coming up before we start the lecture? Okay. It's always nice that everybody's completely clear when we start the next class. Okay. So my intention today is to talk about the scientific understanding of reality.
And my intention is to talk about it in two different ways, one way before break and one way after break. That's the plan. And the plan is that until break, we will be discussing the history of science as a thought movement. Now, how did science come to dominate our civilization? What was that about? And what was the process through which the medieval worldview transformed into the modern worldview? What went on there? And then afterward, we're going to talk about science from a phenomenological point of view. That is, how can we abstract scientific truth out of our own experience? That'll be after a break. Okay? The reason this is important is because the scientific worldview, as it was formulated by Newton, and as it has been more or less preserved since then, excludes the transphysical worlds. It makes them unreal, imaginary, silly, childish, right? And taboo, in fact. So as long as we're thinking in terms of modern science, we simply find the transphysical worlds unintelligible because there is no collection of experimental evidence that will let you really discern what's going on in the transphysical worlds, because all experiments are always done in the physical world on physical things and therefore cannot measure or detect transphysical things. Okay, so anyway, I want to talk about how this scientific understanding came into being. And as I say, Burke does this really well. And another book you should know about is Nature of Physical Existence by Ivor McClurg. This is an amazing book in which he does very much like what Burt is doing, but he starts with Aristotle instead of starting with Copernicus. And this book also I consider to be extremely important to anybody who's interested in relating their thinking to scientific thinking. It's also a crucial book. Okay, so let's go back then very briefly to Aristotle. And I want to invite us to try to look at the world the way Aristotle did. Remember, Aristotle didn't know anything about scientific instrumentation, and he had this basic assumption that what you see is what you get. That is, the way things look is the way things are. And that somehow the human mind is set up to correspond with reality because they're both sort of part of the same thing. And so there's no problem of knowledge. Our knowledge is just automatically valid. It's kind of naive realism, okay? So I look at the cup, and I realize that this cup is a thing. It's an individual entity that somehow stands out from the others. But that's a very interesting property of it, is its uniqueness. It's detachability, right? And it's detachable from its context. I can move it around. Secondly, if I go to describe the cup, all I can do is enumerate its characteristics, right? Looking from the top, it's round. Looking from the side, it's roughly cylindrical. Looking at it this way, I see light green and white, and so forth. It has all these, it's got paperiness and so forth. It has all these different qualities. So Aristotle said, reasonably enough, that what it means to be a thing, a natural being, his word was ousia, what it means to be an ousia is simply to be a substance with qualities. Right? So what this cup is, It's a substantial entity that has qualities that are being expressed in it. Right? Now, what is substance like? If we take this perfectly reasonable point of view, then we say, what is substance like? So if we take away the roundness and the whiteness and the cylindricalness and the greenness, what's left? Anybody got an idea? What does it look like? What's left? What properties does it have?
Spirit.
Aristotle wouldn't say that, but the basic point is it doesn't have any characteristics, right? You can make that move, but that's not the one Aristotle would make. So the point is that he's saying that substance, you know, substance is a big category for us, right? Substance is things, substance is dense, substance. For Aristotle, substance is formless. It doesn't have any form of its own. All it does is to be able to individualize and to hold qualities together in time and space. That's all substance does. Substance is essentially passive and formless and individualizing. That's it. Yeah.
Even the word itself is defined in relationship to something else. Substance, the thing that holds the other things together.
That's right.
So it's kind of hard to even call it an entity.
But for Aristotle, he made the absolute assumption that there's some kind of entity there. That's Aristotle's thinking, right? Whitehead replaces substance with creativity. It's a more interesting system. But for Aristotle, he just took for granted the existence of substance. And for him, reality is the activity of form expressing itself in substance. Right? So that the cupness here is expressing itself in the substance. And the ongoing self-expression of the form in the substance is the cup. Do you sort of see that? It's really different from the way that we think. Right? You guys getting this? You've been totally bewildered? Does this make sense? Give me some feedback here. No questions? I guess this is making sense. Okay, so this is a really different way of looking at things. Now, one of the consequences of this way of looking at it is that this cup, for example, exists because cupness is expressing itself in substance. The cupness of the cup has nothing to do with the personness of me or the floorness of the floor or the deskness of a desk or anything, right? It just is what it is. Well, no matter what anything else is, the form of cup is expressing itself in substance here, right? So if you start looking at the world that way, the world begins to look like a collection of independent things, and the relationships between them become extremely trivial. Right? Now, there is embarrassment here. What's the embarrassment? It's really embarrassing that this cup, which expresses the form green, would express the form gray if the lights were turned off. This is a big embarrassment for Aristotle's theory. And it was an embarrassment for thousands of years. Nonetheless, in spite of the embarrassment, it was still held. And this is a very, very, very important point. Scandals, obvious scandals, can exist in thought for millennia without either being remarked or corrected. That's an interesting thing to know about human beings. So this embarrassment about Aristotelian thought wasn't really considered until modern times. It was left aside. Okay, now. Relationships, in other words, the bottom line here is that relationships are not important for Aristotle. What's important are the forms and substance, right? And for Aristotle, what we can know about, the way we know about forms is by classification. So the knowledge of forms is a knowledge of categories and subcategories. Right? That's the big Greek contribution. It analyzes categories and subcategories. Now, why is that important? For one thing, once you've analyzed knowledge into categories and subcategories, you have an incredible way of filing your knowledge. You begin, so let's say, for example, you now know, you decide in your new categories, that all eight-legged beings are spiders. And you know from your categories that all spiders spin webs. Right? Okay, now you're out in the woods and you find a new being you've never seen before, but it has eight legs. Right? So you plug it into your table. Eight-legged means spider. Spider means spin web. And so this eight-legged creature must spin webs, even though I've never seen it spinning a web. See, it's a big advance in knowledge. It's kind of an indexing system, right? And for Aristotle, this is what logic is all about. It's sort of an indexing of knowledge. Again, it has nothing to do with relationships between things. It never occurs to Aristotle that this color green is a function of my eyes, of the sun, and of the cup. That it's a relational characteristic. Okay, so now, for Aristotle, all through the Middle Ages, we're living in this dominantly Aristotelian universe in which the relationships among things are not really thought about very much. What's thought about is the nature of things and the forms that express themselves in things. Now, there was another tradition that was not the Aristotelian tradition. This is the Platonic tradition. And in the Platonic tradition, Plato was much more intellectual and less sort of concrete and pragmatic than Aristotle was. Plato was more of an abstract theoretician. Plato was very interested in mathematics. And Plato thought mathematics was intrinsic to the nature of the real world, and that mathematical relations among things were sort of an expression of divinity in nature. And so Plato began to believe that mathematical forms, particularly in the heavens, had to be ultimately determinative. Right? That whatever happens in the heavens had to be under perfect mathematical order. The problem is that when you look up in the heavens, there are planets there, not just the fixed stars. And the planets are moving around in an almost random way, as far as your eyes can tell. They just move back and forth across the sky in this weird way. And so how do we make sense of the movements of the planets? The existence of the planets, for the Greeks, Plato in particular, was an immense intellectual embarrassment, right? Because they thought, for sure, that all celestial movement had to be circular, because if they weren't circular, they wouldn't be eternal and perfect, and they wouldn't repeat. So everything had to be circular, but they couldn't get the planets to move in circles. Right? Now they finally got the Ptolemaic thing, where they got circles within circles within circles, which is okay. But then people weren't satisfied with that, and they wanted to get the exact mathematical relations. And so Kepler made these incredibly accurate observations, and then got it right, and then Copernicus started to put together the heliocentric system, right? Did I get it right? There was three of them. There's Tycho Brahe, Copernicus, and Kepler. Kepler's the one who finally got the equation. So Tycho Brahe did the observations. Copernicus gave us the idea of the heliocentric system, and then Kepler gave us the actual equations of motion. And what it turns out is that in order to understand the movements of the planets, we have to understand their relationship to the sun. And it turns out that in expressing relationships, the best language we have for expressing relationships precisely is mathematics. Right? Because mathematics is actually a study of relationships. That's what it is, right? Relationships among numbers, and then relationships among those things that we can designate by numbers. It's relational. Mathematics is about the relationships between things. And so Kepler's equations describe the movement of the planets relationally, which is to say mathematically. Right? So 2,500 years ago, Plato said, I just know on sheer principle that the planets must move according to mathematical laws. But he couldn't prove it, and nobody else could really prove it except for the Ptolemaic approximations. And the problem languished over 2,000 years, and then Kepler figured it out. Kepler figured out the mathematical equations through which he could calculate the orbits of the planets, and thus vindicated Plato. And so the Platonic tradition, which has been running underground for several thousand years, now zooms up to the surface of consciousness. All of a sudden, Plato's conjecture that mathematics is intrinsic to the nature of the real world becomes a hot topic after Copernicus and Kepler. You with me? Now, the question is, like, for example, as Burke points out, Copernicus, at least, I'm not sure about Kepler, but Copernicus, with his heliocentric system, couldn't do any better than Ptolemy had done. In fact, he's about the same. The only thing to recommend it was its mathematical elegance, because Copernicus could do away with the epicycles. Right, so there's a gain in mathematical elegance in saying that the Earth revolves around the Sun. Now think about it. The Earth could not be moving because we all know what it's like to move. We ride a horse or something, it's dangerous. You could fall off. And if the Earth was moving, it'd be really scary because we'd be moving instead of being still, right? So obviously the Earth is not moving. And if the Earth isn't the center, why does everything fall to the Earth? Why isn't everything just lifting up off the Earth and falling into the Sun, for example? Right? And so obviously, Copernicus's ideas make no sense. Right? Their mathematical results are not in any better harmony than the old theories, and the new theories require us to make the planet move, for God's sake, and we somehow have to explain why we're not falling off, right? And how the whole thing works is incomprehensible, right? So the only gain is a gain in mathematical elegance. And yet that became so decisive, right? People got so excited about that. Mathematical elegance. So this is interesting. Notice people's values, right? This, that the value of mathematical elegance overrode common sense scientific experimental evidence and got people all excited about this new idea. It's interesting to notice that these fashions happen, right? So now we're vindicated. Plato's vindicated. The heavens move according to mathematical laws. And along comes Galileo and says, well, what if we apply these laws terrestrially? What if mathematics also covers the movements of bodies on the, near the surface of the Earth, and not just the celestial bodies? This is a huge conjecture. Plato couldn't even have imagined this, because he thought of sense experience as fundamentally chaotic, and only having a semblance of order insofar as it imitated the divine forms. So he never expected to understand the details of nature mathematically. It never occurred to him it was possible. The whole idea that nature could be known in every detail is a product of 1,000 years of scholasticism, right? In which people began to believe that God had minute control over everything in the universe, so that a leaf didn't fall that wasn't contained and somehow guided by the divine providence. Right. So the Christians began to get this weird conviction that everything is determined by God, down to the finest detail. This is a weird religious conviction that people have that would have been completely incomprehensible in the ancient world, where nobody ever occurred to anybody that you can analyze terrestrial events that way, right? So then all this Catholicism comes along and trains people's minds in a certain way, and they think, okay, we should, since God is involved in everything, we should be able to understand every detail mathematically. It's kind of a nuts idea, right? Who would think of such a thing? But Galileo got that idea, and he made it work. And was able to make it work because of the theory of perspective, which allowed us to think of time and space metrically. And so he got the idea that he could measure movement against periodic oscillation, right? And then he began to put numbers to it. And actually, Galileo described mechanics as a completely mathematical system. Galileo knew enough to realize that his system was a pure abstraction. But it applied, so that was interesting, right? So he came up with a pure abstraction of mechanics, total mathematical system based on point instants and whatever else he based it on. And I forget exactly what Galileo's system was. And so he mathematically... So he discovered, he vindicated the hypothesis that terrestrial movements can be measured and therefore mathematically understood. This is a huge breakthrough. Now, for the first time, this Platonic conjecture, which is ignored more or less for thousands of years, comes to completely dominate the imagination of the culture. We get a mania for measurement and for mathematical relations, right? And then something else that happens around this time, which is that we discover experimentation. The scientific experiment. What is a scientific experiment? First of all, it's a magical ritual. Right? It has to be done in a very precise way, just like any mathematical incantation. If every detail isn't right, it doesn't work. Right? And then what it does is it takes some situation in nature and turns it into a sort of an abstracting mechanism. An experiment is an abstracting mechanism. So for example, let's say a thermometer, let's say I've got a box, right? And the box has gas in it at a certain temperature, and I place a thermometer in the box, and the thermometer reads off the temperature, right? So I've now taken this box and the gas and the pressure and whatever the composition of the gas, and the whole thing, right? And I've abstracted out of that situation a number. Right? And I've set the physical world up so it does that for me. Right? So the number begins to look objective, right? Because it can be reliably and replicably reproduced, right? The same situation can be created over and over again, and each time I do it, the same number comes out. This is an experiment ritual. And this experiment ritual establishes a certain, like, reference point. Right? So, for example, there's all the phenomena of the air. The air is light, heavy, clear, dense, foggy, smells good, everything, right? Weather, complexity of weather. Out of all of that, by constructing a thermometer, I now have a way of abstracting from the weather a number. Think about that, right? It's an abstracting operation. I get out of all the complexity of the weather, I get a number, and then I can start discussing the correlations of those numbers with other numbers, right? So I can play the variation in temperature across the variation of day during the year, right? So I can start plotting temperature against season, or I can plot temperature against humidity, or I can plot temperature against last year's temperature. All these things become possible because I've got an abstraction, right? So what experiments do is they create these little reference points in the world where there's an abstraction going on. So each experiment takes some very complex situation and reduces it to a number, and it puts the number on a line, right? So there's the temperature line that goes from cold to hot, and then there's the year line, which goes from January to December, and then there's the humidity line, which goes from low to high, right? So the scientific procedure abstracts out of nature these linear dimensions of variation. And then it starts, the equations basically show how movement along this line is reflected in movement along this line. Right? That's what the equations do, is they show the connections between variation on one line and variation on another line. This is what science does. This is it. Science does abstractions, which reduce complex situations to number lines, and then develops equations relating the movement on one number line to the movement on another number line. That's what the equations do. And that is modern science. Shocking. That's all it is, right? And so how much conclusions we can draw from that, who knows? But when you start to grasp that, you know that all the ontological conclusions the scientists draw begin to seem very thin. Okay, so now, so Galileo and Newton come along. Galileo comes along, and this mathematical idea captures the popular imagination. Whitehead talks about in Adventures of Ideas, is that ideas pass through civilization. A civilization will hold an idea for a while and then release it, right? So democracy. Whitehead shows how the idea of democracy had a history. And right now in our culture, as a fading ideal, it's still worshipped, right, in our culture. But it's clearly fading because it's not actually observed in practice, only in theory. So that idea is going out of effectiveness, right? So what happened back after the Renaissance is that this idea of mathematically ordering the relations among the entities in the world became extremely fashionable. It just dominated the imagination. Everybody's out doing that. Part of the reason for that is because it's the first time you get an alliance between the merchant class and the intellectual class. With the new scientific revolution, with its dependence on instruments, artisans and intellectuals begin to create this new connection, which is a social nexus. It's the beginning of the military-industrial complex, right? And so that begins to get a lot of energy through it, right? The scientists are bringing money to the merchants are bringing prestige to the scientists. See how that starts to get going like that, right? And so that begins to get cultural energies involved in the scientific thing, because the scientific thing begins to lead to profits. Very important. Okay, so now we've got a culture dominated by this idea of the measurable. We've got interests that begin to direct science along a certain pragmatic, profit-oriented direction, right? And people begin to create a universe. So remember last week, I talked about the despair that I was feeling because I wasn't willing to believe ideas, right? And ever since then, I've been thinking a lot about the seductiveness of ideas. Like, if I'm being in a deconstructionist mood, I reject the seduction. But obviously, most of the time, I'm completely vulnerable to the seduction of ideas. And what does that mean? And what I want to try to say here, I want to try to give you some sense of how the scientific world that we experience, what our common sense world looks like, came into being.
Remember, the common sense world of the Middle Ages was nothing like the common sense world of the modern era. Right? In the Middle Ages, it was really clear that the universe consisted of angels and demons, and God was right here in physical space, and all kinds of things were going on that aren't there in the modern world. It all got shoved out. How did that happen? Okay, so we have our experiment, our little rituals, and we have these reference points. Like, we now know that water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. That's now a reference point. Now, notice that the experimental ritual excludes morphogenetic fields and morphic resonance, because you try to get rid of that, you try to isolate it, right? And it excludes, by design, intentionality. So the idea is you try to set the experiment up so that no matter what move the experimenter is, and whether the experimenter likes it or not, it'll get the same results every time. Right? So an experiment is designed to eliminate all the effects that we now call parapsychological. That's what it does. It's designed to remove those factors. Inside the experimental box, they're irrelevant. That's the whole idea. That you're trying to, an experiment tries to create a situation that's immune to meaningful interference from outside. That's why an experiment's a closed system. Theoretically closed, abstractly closed, right? So now I know certain facts about freezing of water, boiling of water, and about, you know, the density of the atmosphere, and I got all these facts, right? All these experimental results. And then I begin taking these experimental results, and I assemble them into a picture of a world, right? Which is the physical world. The physical world is a picture that I build up by coordinating the results of experiments. Can you see that? Right? So here's the seduction, right? So starts out, I do a few experiments, and then I get really interested in that. And then I begin correlating the experiments, and I begin to see this network of mathematical relations pervading my experience. Right? And then I say, okay, now I've got it. Right? The objective world, the real world, is defined by the mathematical relations among the results of experiments. That's what's real. That's what the scientist is telling us right now. Here's the problem. These experiments have been set up so that consciousness cannot figure in them, motivation cannot figure in them, meaning cannot figure in them. It's like it's really a very abstract situation. And so all those things are excluded from the world picture that I get by coordinating the mathematical results of the experiments. You follow me? The scientific world is an extremely abstract world consisting of mathematical relations among abstract entities. Right? Atoms, quarks, mathematical relations, that's it. That's the scientific world, right? With me on this? Now the question is, if that's real, what's this? What is my consciousness? What is my motivation? What is meaning? What is synchronicity? What is sympathetic magic? What are these things? Well, you can't answer it in scientific terms. And so what happens is an enormous literature comes up, which is a literature of explaining away. So you get large books proving that consciousness is an illusion. Proving that we don't really see anything. Proving that really, you know, like that. We have all these weird things we do. We try to derive consciousness from the interaction of atoms, which is conceptually idiotic. Right? But you see what happens is we form this picture out of these isolated reference points we call experiments. We assemble it, and then we sort of insert ourselves into it, and then we do our best to banish all the rest of experience that doesn't fit into our box. See what I'm talking about? Right, so this is the process that I'm really interested in, this process of being seduced by ideas. The modern world comes about because people, culture, get seduced by the idea of measurement. And so after Galileo, instead of asking what's reality about, they say, given that mathematical relations define what is ultimately determinative in nature, what must nature be like? So they're not asking what is experience like, They're saying, what must the universe be like if our equations work? That's a whole different question. Right? Now, if you ask,
once they started asking this question, what would the universe be like if our equations are true? It took about several hundred years between Galileo and Newton to put together an answer to that question. So they finally put the answer together with Newton, right? And then after that, they began explaining away everything that Newton didn't explain. And that's how the modern world came into being, by explaining away everything that Newton's theory couldn't explain. So I'm trying to give a sense of this feeling of this process. You can see the same thing at the very beginning of human civilization with language. Right? Language establishes a bunch of categories, and that everything that doesn't fit into the linguistic categories is taboo. Or, for example, you know, the structuralists did a lot of work around the idea that civilization is built around certain fundamental conceptual discriminations. So, for example, the discrimination between life and death, the discrimination between male and female, are really critical distinctions that we use in the forming of our reality. Anything that blurs those distinctions is taboo. For example, homosexuality is taboo. Why? Because it mixes up the categories of male and female. Ghosts are taboo because they mix up the category of life and death. So once it appears that the coherent world that we live in is very much a social product, right? We construct it by approaching our experience with certain specific interests. On the basis of those interests, making certain acts of abstraction, connecting those abstractions to an abstract pattern, which then we stabilize as the world that we live in. And from that point on, anything which disturbs those categories becomes taboo, and we have injunctions against it and freak out. This is why, for example, parapsychology is completely verboten, even today, in academic journals. Because it disturbs the fundamental distinctions on which their operation is based. So organizations like PsyCor, you know, that viciously attack anybody who's doing parapsychological research, they're part of a taboo enforcement operation. See what I'm getting at here? And I'm trying to communicate to you how it is. I'm trying to give you this picture, how we establish a few reference points in the world, we assemble them into a picture. And once we get that picture stabilized, we exclude everything that doesn't fit into the picture. And that's how we create a reality to live in. Right? So that repression is a fundamental part of objectification. Right. Yeah, Nick.
I guess for me, characterizing science in this way, like that isn't the term that I would use personally. To me, you're speaking more about scientism. And sort of a, you know, I appreciate how you're highlighting, you know, kind of the irrational nature of this kind of project and how there's all these kind of pragmatic interests. And, you know, to me, science in a sense of, you know, preserving the kind of more rational kind of vision that science held for itself would be open to all evidence. And
yeah.
There's no sort of like, you know, sort of a, there, what you're saying is that what you're calling science is actually kind of a pre-rational, mythic project.
No. Well, I'm calling science, for one thing, we have a definition problem. The word science has a lot of different uses in our culture. And so, for example, if you talk to a scientist and say, what is science? Most of them say, their knee-jerk reaction, in my experience, is science derived from the root scientia, which means knowledge, and science is therefore rational knowledge. But now, we can use the word that way, and in which case what you're saying is totally legitimate. But I use the word in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I use the word science, I am referring to a particular philosophical movement which began with approximately Kepler and those guys and has continued through. It's a modern phenomena having to do with the mathematical descriptions of nature, right? And that's really what I mean by science when I use the word.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an historically situated usage that I'm using. Right? And I would question the larger usage of the word science, which I think is misleading.
myself. It's legitimate. It's definitely done. People do define science that way. But then we lose the distinction between science and the larger knowledge project. So by your definition of science, the Buddha was a scientist, and Lao Tzu was a scientist, and so forth, right? Because it's rational knowledge. You're developing rational knowledge of the universe.
I wouldn't call it science.
So where would you draw the boundary?
Well, I think, you know, science has to go through, you know, four kind of stages, and so that would include a much more rigorous kind of social validation project at, you know, in the last stage, right. Whereas there's not really a peer review of Lao Tzu's claims and so
on. That's not true, by the way.
Well, there's a tremendous,
in those days, there was a tremendous peer review situation set up. It just wasn't set up along the same lines. Shrivinder writes about this a lot.
So you think there, for example, that people are performing the same injunction that the Buddha's performing and having a sort of rigorous, rational debate as to the claims that he's making?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't know enough about that to make that claim, but so in that case, it would be science.
Okay, but the point, here's the thing, like, this is one of those words that people have an emotional attachment to. People who've been brought up in a scientific civilization like to think science is a great thing, and so they tend to broaden the definition so that science begins to encompass a very wide area of human. Any rational knowledge then becomes science. Any systematic rational knowledge becomes science. You can do it that way if you like. That's okay. I prefer to use the word science to refer to a particular modern movement that starts with Kepler and Galileo and those guys and extends forward. So when I use the word science in this class, that's what I will mean, not what Nick means, even though Nick's meaning is totally legitimate and very widespread in the culture. I'm just going to say, for the purpose of this classroom and this discussion, I want to confine the word science to the modern movement that's mathematically oriented and so forth. Yeah.
Don't know that I've ever actually thought of it this way that's sort of coming up here, but it seems like that broadening of the definition is a way of negating everything that fits outside of the definition.
Yeah.
I mean, if you exclude all rational knowledge, then you're to speak of these transphysical situations is to automatically say it's not rational, and therefore you remove the grounds on which you want to speak. It becomes irrelevant, it becomes fanciful, it becomes imagination, it becomes something other than rational knowledge.
I said, but actually, my whole point in this class is that you can have rational
knowledge. And that's what I'm saying. But if you commit to saying that science is all of rational knowledge, and you can't perform this move that you're speaking of.
That's right. Okay. So there's two points I want to make here. One of them is, I want you to get really clear that the modern world is based and conditioned by a certain proto or post-Newtonian sensibility. And that the Newtonian synthesis emerges out of a very specific question, which is, if the infinitesimal calculus really describes what's objectively real before experience, then what must the world be like? Now the infinitesimal calculus, which Newton and Leibniz used to analyze motions of bodies, operates on point instants. Right? Those are the mathematical entities that you use in calculus. They're point instants that have fields around them, vector fields, right? I don't know if that makes any sense, but the point is, a mathematical definition of a point instant that's used in calculus. Atoms are simply an illegitimate ontological reification of the point instance of calculus. That's all they are. See what I'm getting at? Newton, in order to describe the motion of planets, had to assume that all bodies were made up of massive point instance. Not point instance, massive points of mass. Points of mass. Point masses, not point instance. They're not instance. They're enduring in time. Okay, so point masses. That's what calculus operates on, is point masses. There's no such thing as a point mass in nature. There's no such thing as a point mass in experience at all. But then what we do is we say, oh, well, since they describe it, they must be real. The point instants that figure in our description of reality must be more real than experience themselves. And so over behind experience, there's this realm of these atoms. But all these atoms are the point instance of calculus. which were necessary to analyze movements, but have no ontological significance whatsoever. Are you following me? Yeah.
Richard. Yeah, could you repeat that question? What if the infinite, you know, because I want to
which
make
question?
Sure. The, you said the Newtonian synthesis arises out of a particular question.
That, what must the world be like if it is accurately described by infinitesimal calculus? That's the question. Not what's experience like, not what is human existence about, not what is it to be alive, right? But what must the universe be like if calculus is the ultimate description of it? Which is a very, very different question. And unless we accept that calculus is the ultimate description of the whole universe, we don't have to buy Newton's conclusions. Yeah.
You mentioned that atoms are illegitimate representatives of the point mass.
Yeah.
Point instance.
Point mass. Point instance is whitehead. I got my periods mixed up. Okay. So you get a feel for this process. We were all raised to think that the physical world was there before humans were here, it'll be here after we leave, and that everything in the universe can be understood if we understand the mathematical relations among the things that the universe is made out of. That's what we've been taught. I'm reading Feuerstein on Gebser, and Gebser says, you know, you can't really say how long ago the magical period was. But how do we know, since it was timeless, right? This is what Gebser is saying, look, in the modern mental era, we create this map of time, which is good for our local experience. And then we project that map off into the distant past and the distant future. So we think we have the right to put a date on things that were timeless. But do we, really? Do these projections of ours actually spread off into the distant future and the distant past? Can we assume that the same laws applied 14 billion years ago that applied now? Why should we assume that? Right? But unless we assume that, we can't deduce the Big Bang. So what I'm trying to convey to you here is that I find myself moving into an enchanted universe, and as I do so, I find the comforting certainties of the scientific era dissolving out from under me. I no longer believe there's a physical world. I no longer think that category means very much. I think everything is alive. I think everything has intention. Everything is making choices. I think the solidity of the floor is due to the continuing decisions on the part of the actual occasions making it up. It's dynamic will that's keeping this building up. Right? Right? It's a different feeling about things, right? It's like the whole universe begins to seem a lot more shaky, you know? It's like, I'm walking along this floor, 60, 80 feet above the ground, and I'm thinking, well, hope they keep making the same decisions, you know? Okay, so the main point is this, what I'm trying to establish is that the physical world is an abstraction. It is nothing real. This has a lot to do with quantum mechanics. You know, those of you who know about quantum mechanics, there's the issue of the classical world and the quantum world, and they're trying to make them both real. No, the classical world is an interpretation of the quantum world, and the quantum world is the world that we live in. Yeah?
Of course, I don't come from a philosophical background, but would it make more sense to say that how we interpret the physical world is an abstraction based on this kind
yes.
of science?
No, not exactly.
But that
see, no, no.
The physical world might still
no.
actually
no.
really truly exist.
No. No. I would say there is an actual world, but the physical world is a mere abstraction from it. There's no
not
reason
of how
what?
We're interpreting or experiencing.
That's right. The physical world is an interpretation.
With or without us? With or without our participation in perceiving the world? It's an abstraction.
Yeah, well, it's a part of reality. So, ontologically, I would suggest that the physical world is a small part of the real world. And there's a much larger world in which it's embedded. Experientially, I would say that in order to discover the physical world, we have to abstract it from our experience. And we'll talk about that again after the break,
okay.
That process. Okay. So I think that's what I wanted to cover here. Again, I want to say it once more. It's that if you begin to understand how the historical process through which science gripped the imagination of our civilization, then you can start to realize that the physical world is not something that's objective and real, although it may be in some sense, not in the sense the scientists say it is. It is not the ultimate foundation of reality, and it is not as abstract as the scientists say it is. Right? It's just an abstraction from experience, a small cross-section of experience that has become very intently attended to, and that has created a literature and an attitude which excludes everything that doesn't fit into it, and so it seems like it's obviously real. But it's only obviously real because it's unexamined, and it's only unexamined because it's so well defended by a whole literature which keeps it immune to the genuine attacks that it deserves. Right? See what I'm saying? This is so important because what I'm trying to get at is the way we socially construct our picture of the world. The physical world, I'm trying to say, is a social construction. It's not unreal, but it's a social construction that abstracts certain patterns out of the real world and pays a lot of attention to them. But those are not the most important patterns or the ultimate ones in any way. That's what I'm trying to get across to you. Okay? Yeah.
What would you call the movement where language played the role that you're saying science played in this era, where that...
That's the magical era that we talked about.
That, for, okay.
Because Getzer says the magical era is the era in which language is developed.
Well, how would you distinguish the two then if that was also an activity of categorization and a way of symbolizing experience so that you have an abstracted environment to walk into?
Yeah, good question.
What is the true difference then?
Well, you know, we talked about it last week, and I'm not going to give you a deep answer, but I'm going to say this. The answer is in Gebser, and it has to do with configuration of the different mutations of consciousness and how they each work with this process differently. Basically, very simply, in the magical era, the mode of understanding the universe is in terms of synchronicity. Synchronicity is the basic category of explanation. Whoa! Something happened amazing. That's the explanation. Something made an amazing thing happen. That's something we call mind. That's magical thinking, basically. It has to do with gestalts. It's very concrete, very much oriented toward the concrete details of the situation. Then we get to the magical, mythical mode. Instead of seeing in terms of synchronicity, we see it in terms of persons. So the activity of the mythic mind is personification. The mythic mind doesn't see things as having qualities, it sees them as having a physiognomy. Right? Every object is an act of expression, and every expression is meaningful. So in the mythic mutation, everything is a face. This whole moment has a face, right? Each view has a face, the room has a face, everything is alive because we apprehend it in a living way. See what I'm getting at? Person is the category there. And then for the mental mutation, the category is objects. Right? So we go from synchronicities to persons to objects as we move through the mutations. In each case, they're abstractions, but they function very, very differently.
I think David Abrams suggested the written word and actual consistent images contributed to this. The magical and mythical is very oral, and the process of speaking and language sort of lends to that.
That's correct. There's no question that when we move into the mental mutation, the visual sense becomes the most important, whereas in the earlier mutations, the auditory sense and perhaps the visceral senses have been much more important. And the only thing there's a tendency in some of these literature become very mental to say, we invented the alphabet and therefore, I'm saying, with Gebser, we went through a mutation of consciousness and therefore invented the alphabet. So I'm just...
And if you want to talk about this in more depth, the study group would be a great place to bring it next week or any other time.
Awesome.
So, anyway, are you on the list for the study group?
I think so. We signed up last week.
Well, if you're on the mailing list for the class, I should have been able to get. If you haven't been getting my emails,
I was sort of overwhelmed with all the new pieces.
Yeah. Well, you can come give me your email address afterwards if you want to make sure.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm hearing great things about the discussion group, so I highly recommend it. Yes.
So you're talking about the intellectual seduction of the scientific trick of misplaced concreteness.
Yeah.
But when I think of science myself, I'm heavily affected by the fact that with it, you can build airplanes and cell phones and AK-47s.
That's right.
That seems to be enough. I mean, it has so much physical power.
It does.
To it that it blows away, you know, ghosts and magical beings if you want to fight another.
Well, but it doesn't, you see. That's right there. That's the spell. Okay. That's the spell.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm asking how.
Well, because that spell, because the scientific domain is explicitly a domain which excludes the parapsychological on purpose from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you exclude the evidence at the beginning, how can you ever discover it?
Right?
So yeah, it's a compelling world. I mean, there's no question. Here's what science reveals. Without question, science reveals that in the data coming in through our body senses, we can discover mathematical patterns. Hey, all right! And then we can use those patterns to construct objects and devices that cause a lot of destruction and some convenience. All right, is that the ultimate import of human being? Is that what the universe is really about? Right? Is it just this big structure that develops human beings who understand its mathematical laws so they can construct machinery that destroys the planet? Is that the purpose of evolution? See how I'm getting that? Right? We need something bigger. Yeah.
I was just thinking, that painting beside you, if it wasn't for my mental perspective, I might be kind of scared by that. It could be a curse. It could have some power over me. But it just looks like paint and some wood and canvas, and it just doesn't really do anything to me. And I'm able to actually do the disassociation and contemplate it in a different way than be subject to its power would be otherwise. So
that's right.
I just want to say that there is a good and bad in all these mutations.
Absolutely.
Right?
No, the mental mutation is, without the mental mutation, we could never have any conception of what a projection is. Because a projection only emerges against an objective background. In the mythic, there is no objective background against which projection could arise. Right? Think about that. Think about how wonderful it is to be able to recognize projections in our lives. What an incredible liberation that is. We couldn't do that without the mental mutation. I'm not saying we should do it with the mental mutation. I'm saying we have to watch out for the excesses of the deficient mental. That's what I'm saying. And the thing, somehow I'm not sure I'm getting this through to you, which is why I keep saying it. I'm hoping I'm communicating to you this sense of how we can take a few isolated data points, assemble them into a world, and then disappear ourselves into that world. That's the point. Another example I used was the example of the Renaissance. Right? People are doing perspectival paintings. They're not living in that world. They're living in the medieval world with the spherical thing and everything, right? But they're doing perspectival paintings, and then one day they look up from the painting and realize they're trapped inside of it, right? Because their habits of thought have become so perspectival that they've lost track of the spherical universe and they're now in a cubical universe. They've become Borgified, right? So I'm trying to communicate to you the mystery of how we can create a world, enter into it, and zip it up closed behind us. How amazing that is.
Can you explain a little bit more what the spherical universe is and how that...
Yeah, well, in the Middle Ages, I've talked about this. You look up at the sky, and you see this big sphere around the solar system, and it's got holes in it with God's light shining through, and then in between the sphere and the earth are all the angels, and then below the earth are all the demons, and so all the psychologically meaningful aspects of reality are contained in space in the early mental, in the efficient mental. And then when you get to the deficient mental, the sphere is shattered, and you get an infinite array of cubes. That's why I call it Borgified, right? Because the Borgs are all about cubes. You guys know who the Borg is? Anybody know who the Borg is? I'm sorry. Star Trek, The Next Generation, and also Star Trek Voyager, there's this race called the Borg. And the Borg are these incredibly evil creatures that fly around the universe in these big cubical spaceships. And in the Borg ships, everybody is sort of got half mechanical pieces and they're sort of plugged into the network and they have no individuality, right? And the Borg is supposed to represent the ultimate evil of technology taken over. And then the good guys are supposed to be the Federation, right? Who are sort of have colorful spaceships and red uniforms and aren't plugged into the ship, so they're the good guys, right? Anyway, the Borg is a very interesting collective representation of the evils of technology. I like to say we are the Borg. So that's another dialogue. Sorry to bring you in here. All right, so you guys get this idea about creating a universe and zipping it up and then going in there and zipping it behind us? How interesting it is that we can do that? We all do it neurotically, of course, all the time. Right? So what happens in our lives is we have certain traumatic events, and so we take those traumatic events and we organize them into some abstract pattern, and then we come up with some rule, like it's always important to please other people before I please myself, or something, right? And then we enter the world in which that's true, and all of a sudden the people around us become so much more powerful, and we become miserable and weak, because we've created that world, right? Through a few reference points in the past, we abstract from those reference points, we create a rule, and then we enter the world defined by that law and live in it for the rest of our lives. So this whole business about the way we create realities for ourselves is so interesting to me. And the fact that this whole scientific world is a world that we created for ourselves by certain selective operations of abstraction. And yet now it's become the world that we live in. So that we think, for example, that our story about matter must trump every and all other stories, because that's the real story. And so if people thought they were living timelessly in the mythic, they were obviously deluded, because our story trumps theirs. Why? I haven't found a good reason why our story should trump theirs yet. Yeah,
I mean, I'm thinking a lot about this, and one of the things that I think is important is that what you're describing accurately, I believe, is a closed system. And ironically, anybody who's really involved in science, in your use of the term or the other uses of the term, these days ought to know about Kurt Gödel and his proof that you can't come up with a system that's complex enough to include arithmetic and have it be both consistent and complete if it's based on a finite number of statements. And so, you know, even within the system, there's a shattering of this closure. And even that, like you're talking about, you know, all these things, these scandals that went on from the time of Aristotle, mm-hmm. and were just sort of shoved under the rug. So here's something that's like absolute proof within that system is not correct in this respect. Yeah. And yet even with that, yeah. there's not the acknowledgement or recognition right. of its shortcomings.
So let me say two things about that. How many of you are familiar with Gödel's proof? Some of you. Okay. Gödel was a mathematician. I guess he was mid-20th century.
Right? Yeah, he published his thing in like 1931, around then.
And he was a brilliant logician, and he created a very interesting proof, which is famously reliant on self-reference and so forth, but not getting into all of that, one way of translating the significance of Gödel's proof is that he showed that the notion of truth is richer than the notion of logic. He showed that logic can never cover the territory of truth. So if you take any logical system, at least as complex as arithmetic, it's not that complex, if you take any system at least that complex, Gödel can show you that there are true propositions in that system which could never be deduced from any of the theorems of the system. So there's always true propositions in the domain that the system can't cover. It's always incomplete. So every logical system is incomplete. This should, for example, prove that there's no such thing as a grand unified theory. But do physicists listen? No. But Second thing I want to say is that the world that we live in is not fully closed. And that's a very important point. It's only partially closed, and the closure is maintained by tremendous effort in an ongoing way. Right? So it's not really closed. It's only apparently closed because we work so hard at keeping out everything that would break open the closure. Right? So that a world has to be dynamically maintained through a system of taboo, or it disintegrates. That includes the scientific world, right? Which is very heavily hedged with taboos all around, right? So that's the point I want to make. The scientific world is a construct. People spend zillions of dollars and countless careers on defending this system from its obvious flaws. Okay. Amazing. Yeah.
So I'm still pondering the technology issue, and actually it seems like warfare is the prime thing, and it would be an alliance. You spoke of the military-industrial complex. You were talking about the industrial-merchant complex.
Mm-hmm.
That brings us all the hell that we have, you know, just increasing that game. Star Wars, we got bigger things to blow up, bigger planets. But so, what if you wrote, what if you had like a Buddhist science fiction, or you had a transphysical world science fiction, and perhaps telepathic communication would allow a whole different thing that would trump.
That's my whole point.
And actually, even in that game, what needs to happen is that the warfare inside gets vanquished, so that... Yeah, so the whole premise of separation and so forth that the competition is based on disappears, and that might come out of transphysical worlds.
Well, it might help, because in transphysical world, the separation among beings is less sharp than it is in the waking world. Right. And there's much more interpenetration and more interfusion, which ought, therefore, to make morality more natural. That's my hope. I don't know. I mean, they also say that the greatest intensities of evil and good, both, take place on the astral plane, where there's unmitigated evil at a level that would just fry us to a crisp if we encountered it here in the physical realm.
Hmm. Okay.
So it's not all roses.
Well, so you have to go to Aurobindo and go to some enlightened place, right, to get the one.
Yeah. Actually, if you go beyond the lower astral world, you're beyond the good and evil.
Which is where Rumi resides, I believe, because he said, beyond the field of good and evil, meet me there, right?
Yep, that's right.
Are you done?
No, I was going to actually ask a question. My question is, I don't want to ascribe to predominant worldview that exists, because I do see, I mean, just one has to look around at the status quo to see how much of a challenge it poses to most people's lives. But I'm curious to know what you mean by, you know, zillions of dollars are spent defending a system with obvious flaws. I can see the flaws when I look into them, but they're not that obvious.
Well, for example, obviousness is relative, and depending on what you studied and what you thought and all kinds of things. It's obvious to me that Newtonian science is incapable of explaining consciousness. That's a big, embarrassing problem. That's been a scandal in thought. Also, if Newton's right, all knowledge is impossible. And yet everybody's been acting as if Newton's right for 300 years.
Right.
And it can't be right, because then knowledge is impossible. Right. So you see there are these scandals, these problems that come up. And people know about these things. People have known about this, as I said last week, for hundreds of years. Blake saw it immediately. Contemporary with Newton, he said, God save us from Newton's one-eyed sleep. He saw right through it. Right at the time it was written. The whole Romantic movement is a protest against Newton and mechanical thinking. Right? The whole continent was swept up in an anti-Newtonian movement for hundreds of years that we're the inheritors of. And yet our society still acts as if Newton's right. I find these realities fascinating.
I have a question about your conception of rationality or the type of rationality we bring into understanding the transphysical.
Yes.
Do you disagree that rationality is by definition limited by its need for closure? And because all the sort of scientific problems or experimental problems you brought up are essentially the philosophical problem of change in different forms, whether it's you turn off the lights, colors disappear, the planets are wandering, that's a change that I can't order. So are you saying that rationality does not have to be based on definitions and closure, and there is a kind of rationality?
No. Rationality is based on definitions and closure. Rationality is what rationality is. I'm not saying anything really radical about it, except that it's relational instead of Aristotelian. But other than that, logic is logic, and I'm not trying to say I'm saying that the kind of logic we use to describe the physical world ought to be used to describe the transphysical worlds. Right? So obviously the first thing we have to do in the transphysical world is to start categorizing things. What do we observe in the transphysical world? What kind of beings are there? The Theosophists took a start at this. You know, they have lists of different kinds of flora and fauna you find on the astral world. We need to be able to dream and start having categories. That's the first step. You got to get categories. Then we start thinking about the relationship between things in different categories. Right? We need to bring rationality into our transphysical experience. Which doesn't mean we're going to explain them scientifically, because as I've said, there's no measurement in transphysical worlds. But we had rationality without measurement. Maybe we can form an Aristotelian science of the transphysical worlds. This is a starting point, right? We got to have some starting point like that before we can start to analyze functional interrelations. That's where science really comes into its own. The point of mathematics is that it enables us to describe functional interrelationships among things. So we need some language to describe the functional interrelationships among dream entities. And it's going to be a different logic because it works differently. Right? But it's still going to be logical. It might be a logic of symbolic resonance. Maybe we need to develop a whole new kind of logic. That's the challenge, but we're going to be able to think it through. That's the point. All right, let's take a break. And over the break, I'm not sure I'm communicating. You all guys are being very quiet, and maybe I'm saying too much, and you guys haven't got the right questions, but think about it over break. If you have any real questions.
What was that last bit you said? It might be a logic of symbolic resonance?
Yeah. Okay, well, as you come back in, I want to make sure you're secure. Okay, so I talked to Linda over the break, and she said that what I'm saying is a little bit too obvious, and that's why I'm not getting the kind of response I'm looking for. Any questions about what I presented this morning? I mean, I realized that this whole idea that we create a reality, the way I talked about it, is so new for me that I'm profoundly thrilled about it. And probably for other guys, it's more obvious than you thought about it. Anyway, any questions or comments about that historical approach to the deconstruction of science that we did this morning?
When we get back to Gebser's understanding of how time and how the process of this evolution actually...
Not in this class. We're going to do Gebser again next semester, but we're not going to go back to Gebser in any formal way in this class.
But again, great study group topic.
Yeah.
So, you know, bring it if you want. Yeah.
Great.
And just as a brief plug for the study group, in the kind of context of what you just said, it was really helpful today that Richard gave us some kind of historical or contextual background for some of the material, which was, I thought, interesting.
Excellent. Okay. So my plan... Yes?
Another way of thinking about the relationship between the physical world and the actual world and the distinction that you're trying to draw there, it's so difficult for us to grasp because the common sense is that those two are synonymous.
That's right.
But there's a distinction that Galileo, I think, first made between primary and secondary qualities.
Right.
Right? Where right. Primary qualities were what was really physical.
Right.
And the secondary were just, you know, colors and tastes and smells and stuff
exactly.
that were just added to it by the perceiver,
right.
The subject. And that in Galileo's time, that kind of there were some inconsistencies, but it kind of worked. That you could just measure mass and motion as primary qualities and say that's the real physical stuff that's going on. But then as science progressed, eventually more and more what were thought of as primary characteristics were kind of, you know, pushed over into the secondary characteristics. And all that's left now with quantum physics is number and quantitative relationship. So even solidity, which you would think is the most physical of qualities, is no longer considered a primary quality of the physical world.
Exactly.
So it's like even within science and this thorough investigation of what was thought to be physical, it's turned out that there's really nothing left.
That's correct. So what's happening there, now we can think about that in two different ways. On the one hand, we can think that science is sort of penetrating deeper and deeper into what's real, and therefore sort of moving through solidity to discover something deeper. Or we can think that the explanation is getting more and more abstract until it totally loses touch with anything actual whatsoever and becomes a pure mathematical system.
Right.
So when I ask, it's a quantum physicist I know, when I ask him, what's the physical world? He says, the physical world is the world described by the equations. Pretty interesting, right? The physical world becomes purely abstract. It has nothing but numerical properties. But if the physical world has nothing but numerical properties, and if everything comes out of the physical world, then in consciousness is impossible. As is feeling, purpose, intention, everything, right? Because all there is numbers, and if there's all there is numbers, you got nothing to experience the numbers.
But right? Where do numbers exist?
What?
But where do numbers exist?
Well, obviously, I would say numbers exist in the consciousness of people. But of course, if everything is numbers, there aren't any consciousnesses to apprehend them. And so you get numbers relating to numbers. And wait, what is that? A world of numbers relating to numbers? What have you got? Right? It's got to be something actual that relates things to each other. Okay, so what I want to talk about now is the deconstruction of science from a phenomenological point of view. Now, let me clarify why I'm spending a whole class attacking science. Why would I do this? Right? I'm doing it because if your mind is unconsciously dominated by scientific ideas, then the transphysical world will become unintelligible to you. That's my point, right? So the point is that we've been rejecting the transphysical world as childish illusion because we can't fit them into our scientific theories. So as long as we think our scientific theories are somehow ultimate, we're never going to get the transphysical world. We have to rethink the entire world from the ground up in order to do justice both to science and to occultism and to mysticism. We have to do justice to all three. They all have to be true in the same universe. Otherwise, we can't think it through. And if we start with science and grant it some kind of special ultimate status, then we will never think through the waking world, the occult world, and the mystical world altogether. We have to reconstruct from the very bottom up in order to do it. And in order to get to that, we have to deconstruct science, and we have to see how it is that science systematically excludes the transphysical. And then I'll show you why it doesn't have to. Okay? Now, so I want to approach this, now that I've approached it historically, which I think is psychologically immensely important, the other way we can begin to wake up from the scientific trance, where we can begin to pull our heads out of the sack that we've zipped them into, is to look at science phenomenologically. In other words, what is science? How can we locate the physical world in the field of our experience? That's the question. Now, I've done a very elaborate analysis of this in the first four chapters of my dissertation, which I highly recommend to you. The chapter four, I build up to chapter four, where I'm able to say, what is the physical world? I have a whole definition of the physical world as it's abstracted out of experience. Now, I'm going to give you a very simplified version of that today, so you get a sense of the movement of the argument. But I've worked it out in great detail in my dissertation, which is on my website. It's called Doctrine of the Subtle Worlds. So, the first thing we have to do is to
catch sight, as it were, of the field of experience. In one of his books, Whitehead calls this fact, with a capital F. Right? What is fact? This is specialized. This is not the ordinary use of the term fact we talked about last time. This is a highly specialized usage, which is only for this one context. Okay? With me on this? I'm using the word fact today in a very specialized technical term coming from Whitehead's book on relativity. Okay, so what is this field of fact? Well, I notice that the field of fact includes the sensory channels, visual, auditory, tactile, olfactory, gustatory, and so forth. I also notice it includes other senses, like my sense of balance and so forth. It also includes other senses, like my transphysical senses that I use to see images that might give me information about other people or about events in the transphysical worlds. All those senses, they're all part of this, right? And then also, as part of what I am in each moment, along with all the sensory input, is all the internal agitation through which I interpret my sensations into a picture of a world. So, thinking about ideas, forming propositions, putting up hypotheses, testing them, all this activity that's going on in my mind every minute as I construct my interpretation of the world, all of that is part of the field of my experience. Right? It's a very rich, complex environment that we find ourselves in moment to moment, just full of possibilities. Now, if we want to find the physical world in all of this, we have to do a lot of abstraction and a lot of limitation. So the first move we have to make is we have to abstract from all this field of experience only those experiences that are coming in through the physical senses, right, through my bodily senses. To do science, I ignore everything else. Right? I'm not taking anything else's data about the real world except what comes through my physical senses. That's number one. Number two, within the domain of my senses, I only pay attention to those sensations that figure in operations of measurement. Right? That's what scientists do. They measure. I was reading today, Max Planck says, the job of the physicist is to measure everything that's measurable and to make everything that's not measurable, measurable. Max Planck said about physics, right? That's the objective. Everything in the physical world is measured. That's the primary definition of physical reality in science. It's physical if it can be measured. That's what physics tells us, right? Now, what is the implication of that? If what is physical is what can be measured, let us examine the conditions under which measurement is possible. What makes measurement possible? Now, this is something that scientists don't ask. It's one of those Kantian questions. What are the preconditions, right? What has to be true if I'm able to measure something? First of all, we have to realize that all measurement eventually comes down to a comparison to either a ruler or a clock. Those are the ultimate measuring instruments, are rulers and clocks. I might have an incredibly elaborate experiment involving hundreds of people and billions of dollars and involving incredible amounts of apparatus, and at the very end of the whole thing, somebody reads a dial, right? It's a ruler. Where is the pointer along the ruler? Or somebody counts how many periodic oscillations will occur between two events. That's what measurement is, ultimately. It's very simple, which is weird, right? We have such complicated ways of doing it, but in the end, measurement always involves a ruler, which physicists call rigid rods, which I find interesting, and then clock, which they call periodic oscillators. Now, without rigid rods and periodic oscillators, there's no science, there's no physical world. Period. Okay, what are the conditions under which rulers and clocks are possible? Now, what I want to suggest to you is that there are no rulers and there are no clocks in dreams. There might be something that looks like a ruler or looks like a clock, but it isn't, because everything in the dream is alive. Everything in the dream is adaptive.
And so trying to use a ruler to measure something in the transphysical world is like trying to use a snake to measure something in the physical world, right? Or a rubber band. You're trying to use a rubber band for a ruler. It doesn't work, right? Because in order for something to be a ruler, it has to be a rigid rod. Now, what does that mean? It means the various actual occasions involved in the existence of that rod are all doing the same thing, moment to moment to moment. You can't have a ruler unless it's made up of entities that are extremely habit-bound. Number one, right? So you can't have a ruler except in the physical world, which is a world of inorganic entities that are not improvising very actively. Number one. Number two, rulers and clocks only work if your geometry is metrical. And we talked about this the other day, metrical and non-metrical geometries, right? But basically, to simplify it, it has to do with parallel lines, right? So if I'm going to measure the desk, and it's this, the chair is this far apart, and I go over to the, door and I measure, right? Will this chair fit through that door? Right? If I measure it over here, and I go over there and measure it, first of all, I have to assume that the ruler has not changed its length as I've walked across the room. Secondly, I have to assume, in effect, that there are networks of parallel lines pervading the space, so that what's 18 inches across over here is also 18 inches across over there. So there are parallel lines intersecting the space that make it valid, right? If the space didn't work like that, if the space didn't have parallel lines in it, you couldn't measure. Because when you moved around, the very meaning of distance would change. If your coordinates are, picture a Cartesian grid with all the lines being wavy. Well, you can't measure anything in that, right? Because you need standard units of distance. And if your geometry doesn't have parallel lines in it, you have no standard of measurement. So the bottom line here is that measurement is only possible when you're dealing with entities that are very, very habit-bound, like rulers and clocks, right? And when those entities find themselves in a metrical time space. Yeah.
I was just thinking that rulers never change over time, and clocks change at every instance of time.
Yeah, but they oscillate periodically, so the relationship is constant. That's the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so...
Eric.
Yeah.
How does your thinking about this apply to psych research, which is often based upon self-report of subjective states?
Yeah, self-reports of subjective states are fine, and you can give them numbers, but that's not scientific measurement at all. For example, I say, how much do you hurt? And you say, 7. That's useful to me as a doctor, because then you might come in tomorrow and say, my pain's now an 8, so my treatment didn't work. But beyond that, it doesn't tell me anything about your physiological condition. It doesn't tell me, I don't know what your pain threshold is. I don't know how much you ignore pain and how sensitive you are. So the same pain that might be an 8 for one person might be a 2 for another person. I don't know. It's not a scientific measurement. It's numbers used as a language for the expression of emotional intensity, which is not the same thing as a measurement, which involves rulers and clocks.
It's published in the same journals, though.
I don't care. It's a totally different operation. Do you see what I'm saying? Do you get why this is a different operation?
Right, but I'm saying culturally that's not how it's treated. Physiological findings are published next to self-report findings.
Listen, I never cease to be amazed at the incredible contradictions and inadequacies of public discourse. I'm amazed every day at how much ridiculous stuff gets written down and published. It's just astounding, the mistakes you'll see in books.
But couldn't you see that as progress?
No, it's not progress. It is not progress to confuse numbers as a subjective expression of intensity with numbers as a relationship to rulers and clocks.
Well, that we're even paying attention to something that's not identifiable physically.
Not measurable. Yeah, I believe that most of reality is not measurable, and that the task of science is that of coming up with rational ways to work with non-measurable phenomena. And I don't think pretending you can measure them by putting numbers on them is a valid way of going about it.
I think it brings up the broader question, though, of qualitative inquiry, of qualitative science.
Yeah, it does. I agree we need qualitative science. And a lot of interesting questions that come up. I don't think we can do a science of the transphysical without a science of the qualitative. I don't know how to do that, but that's the task. Right? But it's not, so I agree with you. But I'm just saying that the science of the qualitative does not involve numbers. Bill.
Yeah, you're a psychologist, and when you talk about science this way, I mean, psychology is about internal things, and there's all these varieties of it. So is that, you know, and you can use statistics, to figure out how many people have these characteristics?
Well, here's what happens, right? Newton comes along and victoriously analyzes nature mathematically. So everybody and his uncle wants to share in Newton's prestige. And so they go about trying to create pseudosciences which represent unmeasurable phenomena as if they're measurable. And I consider this to be a huge waste of effort.
As opposed to this thing you're imagining could develop, which would be more accurate assessment of inner transfigured states. Okay.
And also, I don't know what the categories of thought are that will help us to objectify the astral world or the mental world. I'm not sure what those categories are. I don't know what the right way of sorting things out is. I mean, obviously, we have to go to the transphysical web to either lucid dream or have out-of-body experiences and study the worlds in which we find ourselves in, right? And begin to categorize the various sorts of entities that are there, make lists of them, and then begin looking at how those various classes of entities relate to each other and trying to find rules that make it intelligible. And I'm not sure what the principles are exactly, because it won't be based on measurement, and it's clear to me that the transphysical world, the forms of things and the intentions of things are also causal. So you can't understand what's going on there without understanding symbolism, because symbolism is causally, in other words, symbolic resonance is causal in the world, whether it's the waking world or the astral world. But in the waking world, the symbolic resonance is vitiated by the ignorance of the physical matter in which it's happening, whereas in the astral world, it's much more clear to see.
So is Jung an example of somebody?
Jung is trying to work out a qualitative science of the transphysical with his whole idea of archetypes. Right? It's very relevant. However, Jung refuses to take the step of ontologizing the collective unconscious. He leaves it ontologically ambiguous. So on the one hand, he talks about it as a realm of images or archetypes, which are sort of patterns, right? But then on the other hand, he talks about how there are these complexes which act just like entities, so that one complex might communicate with several people or the complexes might communicate with each other, right? Well, in that case, you're not dealing with images, you're dealing with actualities in space-time, having causal interaction. But Jung would never take the step of actually embracing his own ontologizing tendency. If you look at his essay on Nature of the Psyche, I forget exactly what period he wrote that, but it's amazing because he goes halfway to say, okay, there are complexes in the collective unconscious and their level of adaptability is higher or lower. So the human ego is a complex in the collective unconscious with a very high level of adaptability. And an atom is a complex in the collective unconscious with a very low level of adaptability. And so in that essay, he almost begins to assimilate physical space into the collective unconscious. And he makes the whole thing a place, which is what I'm trying to do. But then his scientific training and his worry about
culture
gets in the way. And so then he goes back to saying, well, it's all just images. Because it's easier to say that, right? But in fact, his thinking tends toward an ontologization. And that's where my thinking is going. But I think that what Jung discovered is still really important. There are archetypes. There are symbolic resonances. And they are causally effective, both in the transphysical world and in the physical world. And so part of what we need to do here is, and you'll see when we get into the book, my book, in chapter 5 of my book, I'm reanalyzing causality from the ground up to show that there are lots of other types of causality that are involved that aren't even talked about in science. and how they work and what they contribute to the unfolding of events, right? That's what I'm trying to work out. Okay, so we confine our attention to the waking senses, and we confine our senses to the operations of measurement. And we know that the operations of measurement only happen in that domain of our experience, which is metrical and in which there are rulers and clocks. Now, I suggest to you that dreams, the space of dreams, is not metrical. And there are no rulers or clocks in dreams in the transphysical world, because everything there is of a higher grade, it's more adaptive, and so nothing stays the same shape for any length of time, or the same size for any length of time. You see that movie Waking Life? Right? And you know how in all the images are constantly sort of shifting and changing, right? And nothing quite stays the same. That's, I think, an interesting depiction of what it's like in the astral world, where everything is constantly changing. Right? There isn't, things don't hold the same form dreams where they do in the physical most of the time, right? And so it's a whole different world. We have to figure out whole different rules of thought to begin to assimilate it and make sense out of it.
Well, they're inconsistently changing.
What do you mean?
They're not constantly changing, but they're...
Sometimes
inconsistent.
Not. Yeah, exactly.
If it's constant, you'd have time again, but it's...
No. You can have constant change of variable rates, and so there's no fixed. In other words, nothing has a fixed oscillation, but things can be happening at different rates and so forth. So I don't exactly know how to describe this. That's the whole question, right? How do we get lucid in the transphysical world and begin applying our thoughts, sorting them out in an objectifying way, which is what the mental mutation gives us. It gives us objectivity. Now, objectivity is not the be-all and the end-all of human existence. A pure, excessively objectified existence is a poverty-stricken existence, that's the kind that we live in, right? Where our culture is so miserably impoverished by its collapsed imagination. Oh, God, I was saying, yeah.
Since the last class, I've been working with that personally, and I found my dreams have become a lot more lucid, and I have been more conscious of them. And I'm not sure. I haven't figured this out yet.
That's
but,
fantastic.
But I'm working with it, and, and it's something that's ever since you sort of validated my awareness of this, it's really helped me. So,
excellent.
Thank you.
Excellent. That's what I want to inspire. I want to inspire research. Right, I'm talking about a new research program for our culture. We have examined the transphysical worlds so far only symbolically. This is what psychology has been. It's been a symbolic investigation of the contents of what they call the unconscious. Right? I'm saying that the contents of the unconscious actually are entities in a world, and that we can learn something about that world by looking at them, not for their personal meaning to me, but for their objective relationship to each other. Right? So let me say that again. I like that phrase, right? So when I look around the world, if I'm not being a scientist, if I'm just in my mythic mode, the world is for me, and the world is about me. Your behavior reflects me, right? That's why how I look at it, right? The world's either nice to me or it isn't. It's giving me what I want or it's not. It's disappointing me or it's satisfying me. It's a constant personal relationship between me and the world all the time, except when I start to do philosophy or science, in which case I shift to a new attitude. In other words, I begin to approach the data with a different subjective form, with a different mood, with a different attitude. And the attitude of science and philosophy is an objectifying attitude. Right, so I can look at the world with a personalizing attitude and see everything is alive. And it works. It's true. Right? And we can go into a lot of details about that. But it does work. Right? Or I can shift my intention and look at the world as a collection of objects interacting with each other, all of whom have interactions with each other, and I'm not in the center anymore. It's a decentering move, in which I start to look at the interactions among the objects in my world and to locate myself within that network. Rather than approaching the world in an I-thou sort of way,
which is actually what we always do, the mythic mode, which is always with us. But then out of the mythic mode, we pull ourselves out by our bootstraps and adopt an objectifying mode, in which instead of looking at each of you as being in a relationship with me, I look at each of you as being in relations with each other, right? And I see there's a network of relationships that binds all of you, and then I find myself within that network of relations. That's the objectifying mode of thought. And I'm suggesting that we need to bring the objectifying mode of thought into our transphysical experiences. Because by doing so, we can facilitate the creation of continuity of consciousness between the waking world and the dream world. And therefore, we can vastly expand the sphere of objective activity of human beings and find a way through our ecological crisis into an interesting life that doesn't require machinery.
Do we have to move above to have that perspective?
Above? What do you mean above?
So I'm thinking, like, you move above the physical world in order to see it from this objective perspective, and then to move above the next world.
I don't know. I don't know the significance of your question.
I was just thinking, like, you gave an example once of how when we think of the cosmos, the universal oneness, we always put ourselves in perspective outside of that. That's like
I wasn't talking about oneness, I was talking about the solar system, yeah.
Or the solar system, yeah, but we look at it like we're seeing it from outside the solar system, and that's not possible in the physical world, so it's like moving into another non-physical perspective. Or
no. I don't know what you're getting at, but it might make sense, but it's making me uncomfortable. And, the use of the word above, I'm just not sure where you're going.
It's
you know.
Too hierarchical. Outside of measurement.
There are various perspectives from which we can view things. I'm saying we view things from experience. In other words, where is the physical world in our experience? Where is the astral world in our experience? That's the approach I'm trying to advocate here.
When I look at objectify the other world, I'm thinking as if I'm not experiencing it, like I'm outside of it, even though that's not true. There's like this suspension of disbelief that I use.
Well, the point is, you want to be able to perceive the astral world or the transphysical world from within the transphysical world. That's the only place of view. Now, it would be interesting then to look at the physical world from the astral. I'd rather say to look at the waking world from the astral, right? Because that's what we do, for example, in clairvoyance and so forth.
And so then to see the astral world to move.
Well, you can see the astral world from within it. Or you can see it from above. It's two different perspectives.
And that's not my question means, can we rise above the astral world?
Yes.
And get perspective from above the astral world?
Yes, there are a number
of
them.
Look at it more objectively from that.
Well, I would say that going higher is more objective. That's,
okay.
That's really, that just bothers me.
More abstract?
I'm not even sure that's right. And actually, maybe probably more concrete, actually. Because the higher, mm-hmm. I prefer the deeper you go in the transphysical world. I actually prefer to reverse it. The deeper you go in the transphysical worlds, the more richly interconnected all the entities are, the more concrete the situation is, and somehow the less abstract clarity can be gotten. I don't know exactly. These are all questions for me. But you're raising these questions. I don't know how to exactly answer your question. Yeah, Mikey.
What was your last sentence before Caleb's question about bringing an objective analysis into the transphysical world? What was that last little?
I don't know, but that's how I was talking. I don't know. I have no idea. But I am talking about bringing an objective perspective into the transphysical world. Do you want a question about that?
Yeah. Could you just sum that up again?
Yeah. So as we discussed last time from Gebser, our consciousness is able to function in a variety of modes, and in each mode of functioning, we reveal a different aspect of the world. And so in the mythic mode of function, what we reveal to ourselves is the world as a living family of sentient beings. That's what the mythic world shows us. It shows us the universe as an interaction among persons. That's what it really is. Now, when we're in the mythic mode, it's like we're dreaming. Like I was saying, like the whole world has a physiognomy when I'm in the mythic mode. And whatever happens, like, it's part of the synchronicity, right?
So it's like, oh my God, someone showed up, or, you know, oh my God, the sun came out just as I said those words, or whatever, right? It's all about me, right? But in the mental mode, it's not all about me, because I start to say, well, what does it mean if I'm not here? I start to try to, in effect, abstract myself from the scene and to see it as if it didn't need me to exist. Right? So it's an objectifying mode, which says, okay, well, the world's out there, you're all there, you're real, you're all interacting with each other, and so I can't be the only real thing here. I must be part of the reality that we're all part of. That's the objectifying mode. But in the mythic mode, we don't do that. We just sort of like, it's all just kind of like a big drama. You know, in the medieval world, they thought of the physical world as being a stage setting established by God for the human moral drama. That's all they cared about. It was just a stage setting for the drama. But then we get this objectifying mode, and instead of saying, well, the world is the stage setting for the moral drama, we say, okay, maybe, but what the fuck is the physical world anyway? How does it work? We start picking things up, breaking them apart, you know? Stuff like that, mixing them up, see what's going on, right? So I'm saying we need to do that kind of activity in our dreams. So instead of looking around at the dream and saying, what does this mean? You look around in the dream and say, what's going on here? Can I pick things up? How does my vision work here? How does my audition work here? What are the different entities around here? How are they interacting with each other? That kind of question. In other words, to objectify something. One way of saying this, instead of to objectify something, is to place it in the context of space, time, and causality. Those are the three great objectifying thought forms. If I can locate something as an entity in space and time, and identify its causal connections with other things in that same space and time, I'm doing science. It's objectifying. In your sense, Nick, broader sense of science here. If I can objectify, I can start thinking scientifically. To think scientifically is to think in terms of time, space, and causality. So can I start thinking about my dreams in terms of time, space, and cause, instead of in terms of meaning? Now, it's not an either-or entirely, because we'll find out that in dreams, symbols are causally effective. Right? So causality has to take, there's a whole other types of causality. I'm calling them formal causality and final causality, functioning in a distributed way. We'll get into all this in detail. Right? But my point is that it's a different world there, and if we can think of it in an objective way, instead of going to sleep into this field of vague, meaningful images, we're going to sleep into a world of meaningful objects interacting with each other and interacting with the waking world in interesting ways. That's cool. Right? That's the plan. That's the idea. Right? And I'm trying to persuade you guys this is interesting. And then we'll start getting some data we can work with.
How do we decide what objectifying terms do apply to the transphysical world?
Great question.
That's a great question. By experiment, right? We get out there and start figuring it out.
Experiment.
I mean, look, how do we figure out which categories apply in the waking world? How was classification done? Well, first of all, when Aristotle did it, he took the classifications ready-made from the Greek language. And he thought those were just the way things are. He thought the Greek language described the way things really are, and the barbarians just went bar, 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 bar. It didn't make any sense, right? Because they didn't have the right language. That's where barbarian comes from. So what are the right categories? That's the question, right? Now, we know something now about categorization that Aristotle didn't know. We now know that all classification is subject to intention. The way we abstract categories depends on what we're interested in, right? So I'm suggesting that when we go to the transphysical worlds, A, most important, we bring an objectifying interest with us.
But not a measuring interest.
Not a measuring interest. But an objectifying interest that's not a measuring interest. Beautiful.
Pure curiosity.
Yeah. It's like, what's happening here? Right? So instead of saying, what does this mean? I'm saying we should wake up in our dream and saying, what's happening here? You see the difference? It's a different attitude. It's a mythic attitude versus a mental attitude.
Now, I'm not saying we're going to import all the rigid categories of science into the transphysical world, because, as I'm saying, you can't. But what are the categories? Certainly, something Aristotelian should be a good start. What are the types of entities? You can get a list of types of things. That's a good place to start. Then we look at the relationships among the types. We start to play. And the whole creativity of conceptual apprehension, we'll talk about this in the next couple of weeks, right, is how we do it. How we make an objective order. It requires the willingness to go into it with an open, curious attitude and a lack of knowledge, which we do all the time in life, right? You know? Yeah.
I'm curious. I don't have that much experience with remembering my dreams, but I have the sense that when I'm in a dream, I am like the sole protagonist. Everything else is happening around me, which sounds a lot like your description of the mythical.
Exactly.
And so I'm wondering if that's one of the first steps, is to try to move from the mythical to the mental.
That is the step. That's the step.
To say, okay, this is all happening to me, but let me step back and watch what's happening in the dream world.
Yes. You got it. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that what a lucid dream is, or what an out-of-body experience is the experience of bringing the mental orientation into the transphysical world. That's what it is. So right now, we can be in a mythic mode or a mental mode, right? So at 2:45, the bell will ring or whatever, right? We'll all say it's time to stop, and then you'll all start talking to each other, and you'll be in a very mythic mode. Right? You're just gossiping and having friends and having fun, right? That's mythic. Right? Then class starts again and we're supposed to go objective. We shift our attitude into the mental mutation. Right? We do this all the time. But we habitually stay in the mythic mode when we're dreaming. And I'm saying we need to bring the mental mode into the dream space. Not to kill it, but to illuminate it in terms that are appropriate to it. Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot also about this distinction between the objectifying interest and the measuring interest, which I thought was a really good way of putting it. And I guess what I'm trying to understand, I mean, it seems to me that on another level, you're also saying that we need to bring the efficient mental and not the deficient mental.
Yes.
But the efficient mental was when geometry and some of this, you know, I mean, even though the scientific movement that you're talking about started, you know, whatever, 1500, 2000
yeah.
years later, still, even in the efficient mental, there's the seeds of this measuring impulse.
Well, a mathematical impulse.
Okay.
Well, let's be careful. So, right.
Oh, yeah, that's a great, okay, so,
right?
Yeah.
Because in the efficient mental, mathematics is something different than what it is in the deficient mental. Because in the efficient mental, the numbers have not lost their archetypal resonance. Mm-hmm. And so numbers are something very different. They have symbolic significance as well as causal significance.
This is really cool. And I want to remind you of something. Last semester, Linda talked about transdigital stuff. I don't know if you remember. Yeah, she used the term transdigital because we were talking about like... transphysical functions and transphysical mathematics,
right.
And you were pushing back, saying, "Well, no, but you know, we can't talk about measurement or number, but this question of archetypal significance actually might be a bridge that gets back to transdigital functions."
Yeah,
whatever.
That's true. The way numbers will function in the transphysical world was very different from the way they'll function in the deficient mental.
So we could bring mathematics to the transphysical worlds, but we'd have to be really careful about how that relates to measurement. So we've got objectification, mathematics, and measurement as three things that we tend to all put together. We conflate them.
Beautiful.
And now we're disambiguating those
well
terms.
Well said. Really nicely said. So what are those three terms again?
Objectification, mathematics, and measurement.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Keep those three separate. That's really well said, Richard. I like that very much. And so we can't bring the measurement to the transphysical world. We may be able to bring some kind of numerical understanding.
Well,
so
there's a substitution.
Because certainly can to the transphysical
world. Yeah, because, I mean, we look at measurement in relationship to causal efficacy, when what we need to be doing in the transphysical worlds is looking at symbol in relation to causal efficacy.
Right, that's right.
So we have symbolic functions in mathematics. but we need to have capital S or archetypal functions or whatever you want to call
it. Right. I don't know what they look like yet.
Yeah, right. But, you know.
You got it. You got it. You're getting it. You're really getting it. And I notice I'm shouting a little bit, but I'm excited, buddy, because I feel like what I'm saying is so different. Right? I haven't heard anybody say this before. And I'm kind of like, I feel this sort of deep excitement. Like, if I could inspire people to start looking at things this way, we can start getting the data, then we can start getting a science going, right? And what could open up here is just incredible. I don't know what the results are going to be, but I see the method, right? And so I'm just really thrilled about it. Yeah.
My experiences with lucid dreaming, I think specifically the time I tried to jump off a cliff and hit the ground, see if I died. And I would do these experiments.
Right, that's it. That's great.
And I never died, obviously. But I'd stop like halfway down and walk away. And just different things playing with the physics of the of that dream world.
That's it.
But I kind of got bored with it, and I quit lucid dreaming work because I didn't find it interesting. I didn't find it meaningful in its results, and I haven't done it in quite some time.
Well, my suggestion is that if you were to do it in the context of a systematic research program, it might be very different than other people. Right? And start collecting data and giving it the kind of extreme intellectual attention it takes to abstract out the meaningful patterns. Hmm. Right? And it takes a lot of patience to do that. Bill.
This is just kind of playful, but this discussion about measurement and dreams, it just brings up Salvador Dali.
Things what? Yeah.
Salvador Dali, exactly.
You know, with the melting clock.
Got this thought, melting clocks and everything.
Yeah.
He lives there in that transphysical world, and he's just laughing at the rest of it.
Okay, so... Yeah, so basically, we restrict our attention to physical senses, we restrict our attentions to measurements, we then create mathematical rules to relate the results of our measurements, and that's how we define the physical world. Right? So think about this. I start with my whole field of experience, which includes God and the transphysical realms and everything. It's all right here. And then I ignore everything but the physical senses. Then I ignore everything but what can fit into measurement. Then I get a bunch of numbers. And then I make equations to relate the numbers. And that's the physical world. Now, once you see that procedure, does it seem reasonable to you that the results of those measurements should be the ultimate deciding factors in all actuality? You think everything in the universe should be decided by an interaction among those numbers? Does that make sense to you? Once you see how you get those numbers? Okay. And yet, we all make the assumption that the physical world that was discovered by science goes all the way back 14 billion years into the indefinite future. I don't really see any great reason for assuming that. Every week I see less reason for assuming it. It's terrifying me. I feel like I'm actually losing evolution as a reference point. It's really scary. But anyway, That's where the thoughts lead at this point. Yeah.
As you're approaching this idea of exploring the transphysical worlds in an objectifying manner, are you making the assumption that there is sort of an anterior structure to the transphysical worlds, sort of lying around out there, in a sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I'm really interested in those kinds of background assumptions that we're bringing to kind of get going that project too.
Well, starting as starting after next week, we're going to go right into the metaphysics. And I'm going to explicate every assumption I'm aware of.
Okay. That's very good.
You may find some of my own, which would be fantastic. But I'm explicating everything I'm aware that I'm assuming. And my objective is to answer your question in a thoroughly systematic and satisfying way. So next week we'll do theosophy, and then after that we'll go into my book and try to build up a whole system, a whole metaphysical approach. Having laid out the territory, we'll then try to explain it all metaphysically. That's the objective. That's the plan. Okay, well, I'm finished lecturing, so now we can just have a discussion. It's up to you now. Yes?
Have you looked at Robert Monroe's work?
Yes.
Because it seems to me it fits right into
absolutely
this, that they have a mechanism for exploring what I would call second state experience.
experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have a whole map and a diagram.
They're doing some very interesting work down there. I don't know how to evaluate it, but I'm interested. I certainly read his books and found them very stimulating and helpful. I believe what he's describing is a region of the transphysical world that's closest to the physical.
With all the books, he goes through a whole series.
Great, I haven't read the later books. But great, I like his work very much. This guy, Paulo Vieira or something from South America, who writes some interesting materials like his. And there's a whole literature on out-of-body travel and lucid dreaming, which is quite interesting, although it tends to repeat itself over and over and over again. So if you get any one of the standard books on out-of-body travel, you've gotten them all, except for one, which is called Astral Dynamics. And it's by a guy, I think his name is Robert Bruce. And he had the only original ideas about astral travel that I've read for 30 years. So I recommend his book, because it has interesting suggestions for new ways of thinking about things. Yeah?
I have a question. By the way, I'm also thrilled with saying, I've heard other people say that too, when they get really into the lucid dreaming, they kind of almost get bored. And I'm wondering if that has to do with the fact that we're going into these states trying to be objective and losing the sight of the meaning that could be possibly happening.
That's an interesting speculation, and there's probably a trade-off. You're not going to get the same meaning out of a dream if you're looking at it objectively. It'll be a different meaning you're pulling out. And I certainly think both are important. But we've done a lot of symbolism and not a lot of the other. I also think that it gets boring because when we find ourselves lucid dreaming, we find ourselves at a very specific sort of level or location in the transphysical worlds. And if we just explore that, it gets kind of boring, right? But if we have a larger imagination and begin to realize, oh, I don't have to stay here, I could go into a radically different kind of place, right? You begin to get a sense of what's possible there. Because according to Sri Aurobindo, for example, if you're out of your body in a lucid dream, you can meditate and experience God very directly. Or you can experience the Akashic Records, or you can find people in waking life and have telepathic contact. There's all kinds of things to do, right? But if you don't have those informations about the possibilities, you might just stay wherever you find yourself and get bored with it. Because you don't know how to seek out the more dynamic possibilities that are there. So the literature is very helpful. If you bring your mind in there and your mind remembers, which it does, what it said in waking life, think, oh, well, maybe I can call up Jesus now. Or maybe let me try different things, right? And so I think you have to actually know how to move in those worlds to find the interesting places, just like in the physical world. I also think if you, James Inhibitus got this method he calls Somé. Sit, observe, meditate, and endure. So he'll go out in the woods to do a Somé for 6 hours, and just sit in one place and observe and meditate and endure, right? So if you did a Somé in the transphysical worlds, wherever you were, it would start to get interesting if you just really paid attention and didn't get easily bored, but paid more attention and experimented more actively, you start to make it interesting. I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I did that for 6 months in the Mojave Desert, and I just started to notice the boundary between enchantment and disenchantment within myself.
Nice.
And sometimes I would get extremely depressed and nothing meant anything, and then other times I was able to project a magical world on everything, and it was just an interesting thing to see side by side.
Yeah, exploring different mutations of consciousness there, the mythic and the mental. Yeah.
Well, if I could, we could go and contact each other in the transphysical worlds and then come back and write down some message and see if it got through. That's kind of...
That's the Holy Grail.
I mean, those experiments have been done, I think, right? Lots of times.
Well, I haven't been able to find anybody who has had any reliable experimental experience like that.
And why is that?
I don't know. It just seems to me that it's sort of, in a certain sense, it would be the ultimate proof of the objectivity of the transphysical worlds. People can leave their bodies, go there, have experiences, come back and report the same experience or a similar enough experience, right? That would be fantastic. And why that's not happening, I'm not sure.
Well, the one possible explanation would be that these transphysical experiences aren't real, that they're subjective, entirely made up by the individual, and they're creating their own reality.
That's one possibility.
And
another possibility is that in the astral world, subjective In the physical world, we all have our own interpretation of reality. But given the generally sort of dense character of the waking world, we can mostly agree. Whereas in the transphysical, in the astral world in particular, it may be that the whole nature of perception is much more subjective. And that even though I'm talking to you and you're talking to me, I might be talking to you, might look like a dragon to me, and I might look like a butterfly to you, and you know, it's like it's really hard to know how to translate these things back, and so there's a lot of questions to ask.
Well, that's the value of a rigid rod, is that it's rigid over time, and you go
right.
We have the same.
Now, if we could find anything like that in the transphysical worlds, any kind of reference point we can begin to use, even if it's not.
Yeah, the golden rod of the transphysical world. What is that?
Yeah. Or, you know, what are the permanences we can observe there? Right, the physical world consists of recognizes permanence of relationships among sensory experiences. The physical world is recognizable patterns that endure in the sensations that we experience. Right? So we need to know what are the constancies that underlie our various experiences in the transphysical world. Linda?
I'm thinking about how when we first started using rigid rods and periodic oscillators, it was when Galileo translated that from what we had learned about the heavens.
That's right.
So I'm asking myself, with all the new things we've learned in the new cosmology, are there some qualities there that we can bring in to use as more dynamic measurement tools?
Well, as far as I can tell, the new cosmology, that's what you mean by the new cosmology. I mean, the point is there's two different things. The new cosmology, as Brian teaches it, is still based in science. It's a mythic interpretation of scientific results. No?
He has these cosmological powers, which seem to be some kind of tools to use, but they're not scientific, per se.
Right. Well, so what are they? Right? It's an interesting question. Is there something like that we could do in the transphysical? I imagine they all apply, actually, in the transphysical. Does that help us?
I don't know either. Just trying to put things out there
because we're starting
from not knowing.
That's right. I don't know what the right resources are going to be, and some of them may come from the new cosmology, some of them may come from ancient magical traditions. I don't know what the right tools are at this moment.
Yeah. But we have identified some kind of consistency among symbols, even though there's tremendous variation.
That's right.
It seems like there are archetypes that have in some way a consistency.
That's right.
Not necessarily the kind of consistency we're used to.
That's right.
With numerical measurement, but given that measurement is correlated with causal efficacy in some way in this way of thinking,
right.
And symbols are correlated with causal efficacy in transphysical worlds, that would be a good place to try to look.
I agree. Completely.
And then another possibility is synchronicity.
I think synchronicity is common to all worlds.
Right, but in terms of something that we can do in the transphysical world that has some sort of consistency, maybe there's something about synchronicity. I don't even know what that would mean.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing that out there.
That's a good suggestion. I don't think that one's going to work, but there are others that will. Yeah. Bill?
I'm kind of fascinated by what you said about Brian. I'd like to hear more about what you mean by that, because he fascinates me what the twist is that he does without using any fancy language, spiritual language or anything. Seems to me he's doing something similar to Whitehead in that he's looking at the scientific story from inside, in a sense. He wants you to
Brian is bringing
personal light where it lives in you, and you as a non-dual, it's a non-dual perspective. You know, you're part of the evolution, and can you get to that? Can you sense
this,
that? And if you get deep enough, then you get sort of spiritual qualities out of it.
The outlines of the evolutionary story come from science.
Right.
The idea of the Big Bang and the formation of the galaxies and how the suns work, it's all scientific material, right? And it's not just scientific observation, it's scientific construction.
Right.
Right? So the whole business about how the suns, the thermonuclear explosion, everything that's going on, that's all conjecture. Right? in some way. It's put together. It's a construct. So people went out. They did a lot of measurements, and they found things that people found things they could measure. They did the measurements. They figured out the equations that relate the measurements into a system. Right? That's science. Then they look at the measurements and they try to tell a story about them. And usually in science, the story is told in the language of everyday life. That's one of the big things about science, right? They want to claim that the really deep, mysterious processes of nature are nothing but the same kinds of things we see in our waking life. So, for example, they say, string theory. Right? So we're supposed to imagine that the ultimate units of actuality can be represented as pieces of string. And so the ultimate thing going on, the very foundation of reality, is vibrating strings. Right? As if somehow our everyday life gives us the very images we need to understand the ultimate foundations of things. Right? So science identifies measurement, identifies dimensions of measurement, does the measurement, creates the equations that unify the measurements into a system, and then projects into that some image from everyday life, right? Like little BBs or strings or something, right? So that's how science is done, right? Now, what Brian does is he accepts the science, he accepts the measurements, he accepts the equations, only instead of trying to understand those equations with images from, like, everyday affairs, he represents it mythically, as having a face, as having a subject. Right? So Brian speaks about the sun, the incredible generosity of the sun, putting out tons and tons of energy every day for us, right? And he says, it's generous, right? Now, you look at the equations, and you can't see a damn generous thing anywhere in them. Right? You just see mathematical laws governing the flow of energy. There's no generosity in there from a scientific point of view, right? So Brian takes this scientific image that comes from the equations, and instead of looking at it like it's a thing from everyday life, he looks at it like it's a living presence. And so for Brian, the equations disclose the living, mythic personhood of the universe. So Brian's mixing the scientific and the mythic in a really brilliant and original way. It's a profoundly integral move, what he's doing. Right? I'm doing something different because I'm actually questioning the foundations of science itself. Brian and I are going in the same place, but we're trying a different route to get there. Does that help?
Yeah, a lot. Thanks.
It's a little awkward for me because I sometimes find myself being a little bit critical of Brian, which I can never be as a person. But then I get really embarrassed and upset because I think, oh, I don't exactly think what he's doing is not so the way I would do it. You know? And then I feel like I disagree and I hate myself for disagreeing with him because he's a prince. And
I see, that really helps me because I've been like seeing Brian in this sort of like crazy light that I'm like, I really want to understand. I don't want to hold him there. I want to understand it from us. A sort of, like what you're saying,
yeah.
A real way to understand what he's doing.
Yeah, and I think this is the key. The key is he accepts the abstractions of science, but instead of trying to tell the story about those abstractions in terms of everyday things like strings and BBs, he's talking about these things as expressions of the living universe. So he reads the scientific equations physiognomically, that is, if they're the expression of a person, not as if they're the expression of a thing.
Which I personally have a problem with that because I see that the sun is the generosity of God and that the sun is not as complex as humans made in the image of God. So then that kind of language just sets off in me these triggers, these flags of polytheism and idolatry.
Right.
And that's where I, it's really hard for me to sit in that class and listen and not try to translate it into other ways.
Well, exactly. You know, and monotheism is very mental, and polytheism is natural to the mythic. And so Brian's thinking is naturally polytheistic. In a certain sense, each of his powers is a kind of divinity. Right? And I have no problem with that, being a pagan myself, but if you're a Christian, it's a little harder.
Is it more fair to say that he's seeing entities as organisms, not necessarily as personhoods, but organisms?
What's the difference?
Well, I don't know if he thinks it's more important that we move from the mechanistic viewpoint to the organic viewpoint.
Yeah, I'm making a generalization here. I'm saying that an organism is a person.
Yeah, well...
You can do it a different way. We can use the words in all kinds of ways. Yeah. But I'm using it this way. In other words, that when I look at a cell, I confront a living being looking back at me.
But that's only because our image of... Well, just like our image of everything was a little machine, now making it a little person.
I'm saying something else. I'm saying that we have these very, very deep interpretive moods. And that the interpretive mood characteristic of the mythic is to see everything as personified.
Yes.
And the move characteristic of the mental is to see everything objectified. And so, what's the question you were asking? Was like,
an objectivity doesn't.
Right. So, excuse me. So to see everything as the mythic move is personifying, and to call something an organism is to personify it, in my language.
Okay, I see.
Right? Now, I know there are other uses of the word person. I understand that we often reserve that word for people and stuff. So I'm using the word differently. I own that. Right? I'm using the word person to refer to anything organic, anything living.
But we can't use object to refer to anything mechanic. You don't want us to do that, do you? Like, when you say to objectification, you don't mean mechanism.
No, because mechanism is a specific mode of objectification. Okay. That's characteristic of the deficient mental.
And that's another term that we need to disambiguate when we talk about objectification, mathematics, and measurement, as we were talking about earlier. Also, mechanism somehow fits into that as well. Mechanism is correlated to measurement.
Well, mechanism actually is an expression of the mathematization of reality.
Yeah.
In other words...
Now, to carry this conversation a little further, what's the integral move? Analogous to those.
Now that's a great question. What is the integral move? Now what Gebscher tells us, and I can't do any better. Gebscher tells us that in the integral we have a mutual diaphaneity or transparency of all the other mutations in the light of ever-present origin. So what that means is, first of all, that in the integral we do not lose sight of the unconditioned dimension of human existence. In some way, each of us, in each moment, partakes in the unconditioned nature of the ultimate actuality, the ultimate reality of things. We emerge out of that in every moment. And in the integral, that's clear. We don't forget the fact that we are emerging out of the origin moment to moment. And because we understand that, we can see how synchronicity-izing, personalizing, and objectifying are three different modes of existing in the world, and they're all valid simultaneously. And there are complex interrelations among them, and we can navigate them, right? So, for example, in the integral mode, I would be able to both be in the dream and appreciate its meaning while simultaneously being able to recognize the spatio-temporal and causal interactions going on among the entities there while also experiencing each moment there as a profound, magically coherent synchronicity. Or in the physical world, I can do the same thing. In the waking world, I recognize each individual instant in the waking world and a magical synchronicity of the entire universe, and I recognize the entire universe as fundamentally living, and I recognize my ability to make objectifying abstractions from the living universe and to navigate in terms of them all at once without any one of them nullifying the others. That seems to be the integral move.
And your simultaneous recognition is not mental. That's what makes it integral, is that you're recognizing from a mythical and a magical
point
of view simultaneously.
That's right. And so for example, you can imagine telling the story of the mental mutation from the point of view of the mythic, or vice versa. And they're all interesting. You begin to look at how all these different things, right, are creating this multidimensional reality. which we can understand in these different ways, but none of these ways exhaust it. And ultimately, we have to connect with it through our participation in the unconditioned. That's the integral move, as I understand it. And so it's very disorienting. Right? I mean, this is what I'm learning. As I go deeper and deeper into this exploration, I discover how profoundly disorienting the integral perspective is for those of us who've been raised in a mental mutation. Now, particularly, even for those of us raised in the deficient mental mutation, we control our anxiety and establish a sense of security by upholding the ontological ultimacy of the physical world. We feel safe because the atoms that are self-existing and automatic will keep working to keep us alive. Right? We feel like we have some basis to secure our ongoing existence because we imagine it as being this dumb, automatic physical universe. We start to realize that the floor remains solid because of the intentions and decisions of the actual occasions making it up, and the whole thing's, the floor stays in existence as an expression of will. It's a whole different universe, and it's scary. Right? And then we start to realize that we can objectify or personify or synchronicityize, and they're all different valid modes of understanding what's happening. Things get much, much more complicated and much less certain when we move into the integral. Yeah?
Which is a classic issue on a spiritual path, also as you open up. Yep. To these realms.
That's right.
The practices, you get, it's a big issue, is destabilization, orientation.
That's right. For example, in the Vipassana path,
yeah,
I've heard from some advanced teachers that you go through a point, you're doing this noting, and you're dissolving everything into these individual sense impressions you're noting, right? And at some point, your whole world begins to disintegrate, and people go into crisis. There's crises of panic that you go through in the Vipassana path, right? And in some sense, we all have to go through a crisis of panic because the level of freedom available to us in the integral is so vast,
yeah,
and so bewildering.
What's moved me is I didn't consciously want to do this, but I feel like a physical model is just breaking up for me, so I have to.
Yeah, we're driven to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm wondering where psychic experience fits into this. Like, can you get information about a person? Is that like an expired actual occasion, or is it?
Absolutely, it's the objectification of an expired high-grade actual occasion.
So none of that has to do with the transphysical worlds?
Well, yes, because that occasion probably was a transphysical occasion. In other words,
oh, because it never actually happened. You're seeing something that's part of their being in another.
No. What I'm saying is that everything that's actual is a drop of experience. Right? There are drops of experience that are very low grade, that are inorganic, and they find them in the physical world. And there are drops of experience that are medium grade, and feeling and improvising, and you find them in the astral world. So, for example, a cell consists of, we'll develop this in much more detail, the cell consists of a bunch of low-grade actual occasions making up the macromolecules, and a high-grade actual occasion which is organizing them into a self-organizing pattern. And the intelligence of the cell is not in the physical world and cannot be detected by scientific instrumentation. But you can directly experience it because you're also transphysical, and so that the experience of the cell can objectify in you. Or, for example, if I'm like, you know, when I'm sitting with my clients, I have these weird experiences. Like yesterday, I was talking to a client, and all of a sudden, I noticed this overwhelming feeling in me that I was talking too much. I couldn't get away from it. You know, so I said, "I keep feeling like I'm talking too much," and she laughed, you know, and she started talking about her father had talked too much, and how she had learned when her father talked to just sort of go blank and look at him as if she was interested, right? And she was doing that to me. Right? So she'd say something, and I would start to comment, and then she'd look really interested, and I'd keep talking. Right? Now, I thought it was everything was fine, but then my belly was telling me, this is not working. So that what I was feeling in my belly was my direct experience of her discomfort. Directly objectified in me. It didn't necessarily come through anything in her body. I got it directly, astral body to astral body. See? So her astral experience objectified in my astral body, and then I was able to bring it through into my waking world.
So it's being psychic is being able to bring astral phenomena into your waking world?
Yes, or higher, astral or higher. Absolutely. That's it. You see, that's what I'm trying to say.
Eric, just this may be getting ahead and also too much to answer in 2 minutes, but I think you had said that your perception of the transphysical is largely Vedically influenced, mm-hmm. and therefore based in karma and reincarnation.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay, so it's not. You don't carry. Karmic reincarnated.
Well, I mean, the point is the word karma. Where are you going with this? What are you trying to get to?
So my question would then be, what are the karmic implications of dream activity and the decisions that we make, lucidly in dreams?
Okay, well, karma is a very complex term. There's a popular meaning of the term, which imagines a sort of mechanism whereby good deeds in one life are rewarded by pleasures in another one, and bad deeds in one life are rewarded by pain in another one. This notion of karma I completely reject as being simply a convenience of popular religion and having nothing to do with philosophical thought. However, there clearly is cause and effect of some kind. And clearly what I do now has impacts on other people but also on me later. And so analyzing the causal impacts of the past on the future, that's what science is about. And so absolutely, karma is relevant. And all these things have to be sorted out. When we get the book, you'll see I'm doing a lot of work with trying to sort out how causal impacts can be objectified from one lifetime to another and so forth. So I'm developing at least a partial accounting for karma in terms of the metaphysical system that I'm working with here. Does that help?
A little, but you didn't really answer the question about dream activity.
Dream activity, assuming as I do, that dream activity is activity taking place in the transphysical world and is therefore actual, will certainly have karmic consequences. Now, does that mean you'll be punished for having a sex dream? No. It does not mean that. It just means that your sex dream will have causal impact on the rest of your life, however minor. Right? So I'm just for this purpose, I'm talking about karma in terms of causal efficacy. And there may be other dimensions of it. I'm not trying to account for every usage of the term. But I'm saying that I can account logically for a lot of uses of the term. And we'll see how I'm doing it and see if it satisfies. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you so much. See you next week.